What kind of a show are you guys putting on here today?
You're not interested in art?
No.
Now look, we're going to do this thing. We're going to have a conversation.
From Chicago, this is Film Spotting. I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar.
Is she prepared to fall in love? No. Were you? Mm. No. Nobody is.
Right.
You're never going to do it all right, but you can give her confidence.
Yeah.
So that's Ethan Hawke in a clip from Before Sunrise? Sunset? Nope. Just Hawke offering some thoughtful advice on raising your 14-year-old daughter, Adam.
We definitely went there. This week on the show, my conversation with Ethan Hawke. He's had a busy 2018 with roles in the acclaimed First Reformed and the new Juliet Naked. His latest, which he co-wrote and directed, is called Blaze, about the Texas singer-songwriter Blaze Foley.
What sort of top five do we go with for a show like this? How about Ethan Hawke moments? Keith Phipps from the Next Picture Show will also stop by to help us. That and more.
Oh, Captain, my Captain.
Ahead on Film Spotting.
Welcome to Film Spotting. Josh, in your research, all that preparation you did for this week's top five Ethan Hawke moments, did you pinpoint the exact date in this kind of critical reappreciation of Hawke post-Oscar nom for Boyhood? Let's say, when did we exactly start to use the term the Hawkeissance?
Was it before that? Did we precede that?
I don't know. I think it was
your term, right?
Well, I wanted to go with something like that. I wasn't clever enough. I think I had in a top five simply the Year of the Hawk.
Okay.
And then we had Mariah Gates on, and she, I believe, is the first person I heard use Hawkeissance. And then the great Tasha Robinson from the Next Picture Show came on this very show at one point and used the Hawkening.
Yeah, that's...
which might be the best
one. That's the one.
I think that is the one. We'll see if we can actually settle on a date for the start of the Hawkening as we get into our top five a little bit later in this show. We are going to have the help of Keith Phipps from Tasha's podcast, The Next Picture Show. He recently wrote an article for TheRinger.com about Hawke as a reluctant generational icon who is finally getting his due. We will have that top five, and listeners will weigh in with their favorite Hawke performance in the Film Spotting poll. Apparently, the very confusing Film Spotting poll where we included way too many movies you had to exclude, Josh, will explain in a little bit. But first, yes, it really happened. Me, Ethan Hawke. In addition to offering some amazing parenting advice, he was here musing about life and art and sunsets and sunrises of both the Linklater and non-Linklater variety. It's everything you would expect, at least I expected, from an Ethan Hawke interview, dishing out profound little parables, just referencing movies and books with ease. I hope everyone enjoys the conversation, Josh, as much as I did.
Hawke was in town to talk about Blaze, his film about Texas singer-songwriter Blaze Foley. Hawke directed the film and co-wrote the script with Foley's ex-wife, Sybil Rosen. She's played by Aaliyah Shawkat in the film. Foley himself is played by real-life singer-songwriter Ben Dickey. Blaze opened in limited release in August. It is expanding to a few more cities, including Chicago, this month. Now, Foley has become a bit of a legend since his death in 1989 at the age of 39. There are recordings of him playing, but no official studio album exists. He was perennially homeless. His clothes and shoes were famously kept together with duct tape, but he was deeply respected as a songwriter by people that knew him. And that included folks like fellow Texas songwriters Townes Van Zandt, played by musician Charlie Sexton in the movie, also Lucinda Williams and Lyle Lovett, big fans of Blaze Foley. Country legends Merle Haggard and John Prine recorded some Foley songs. And like Foley himself, Blaze the movie is an unorthodox take on the biopic, starting with Hawke's choice to devote a film to an artist few of us are familiar with, which Adam and he discuss in the interview. First, a bit of the trailer for Blaze.
Only one drink, big dog. I don't want any shenanigans from you tonight. Don't make me regret it.
Oh, Lord.
Okie dokie, Smokey Pokey. This next song is my wedding song.
I don't know who Blaze Foley is.
It's Blaze Foley. You really should know who Blaze was.
Didn't try to fall in love with you.
Do you think we're born knowing how to love?
Thing that I can do.
Why do we forget?
To keep myself from falling.
Plain old living, that man.
I've done so many times.
So you're gonna be a big country star?
I saw daylight in you.
I don't want to be a star. I want to be a legend.
I'm going to open with kind of a long-winded one, so bear with me here a little bit.
I like it already.
Watching your movie, I am immediately thinking about the biopic as a genre, conventional ones anyway, which I would say your film is certainly not a conventional one. And often they're concerned, to me, they seem concerned with psychology, trying to explain behavior of these characters rather than maybe trying to just observe behavior. But the other one that really hit me watching Blaze, and it's something I never really considered before, is that biopics on some level are excuses to enact or reenact these kind of signpost moments from characters' lives that we as viewers have some attachment to. They're kind of part of the cultural consciousness. So we care about what's happening. And maybe we only care about what's happening because we have that attachment to it. Biopics then can be a little bit lazy. But when you're making a movie like you did where the subject is someone who's not part of that collective consciousness, we have to be invested the same way we would be with a fictional character. So my question is, how deliberately did you consider those things? How deliberately did you set out to not make a conventional biopic?
Well, I think in the DNA, as soon as you say you want to make a biopic about Blaze Foley, you're shifting the paradigm a little bit, because almost every musical biopic that's ever been made is about somebody who's famous.
Yeah.
Who made it. In the subconscious, the subtext of that is that your story is worth telling because you're famous. And when I was working on this Chet Baker biopic, I was interviewing guys who played with Chet and really realizing they would say that, you know, to really know Chet, you really had to play music with him. I mean, that was where his best self was manifest. And a couple things happened to me, which was that, wow, first of all, I want to make a movie about these guys, the guys who played with Chet, rather than Chet himself. Because the story of celebrity and drug addiction and, you know, the ups and downs of fame, it's just a well-worn road.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, wouldn't it be awesome to see a biopic where the scene where they, you know, we all know the narrative, right? He struggles, something bad happens, these draws a great well of creativity from this pain.
Mm-hmm.
He gets discovered. He rises to the top. Now he loses what's important to him. He falls from grace, finds self, end movie, right? And that's a really boring narrative. And it flies in the face of, I've spent my life with artists, musicians, and most of them are met with just complete and utter indifference. That's not the story of their life mm-hmm. at all. Their story is that of practicing constantly, trying really hard, having some minor little ups, and basically, you know, being ignored. That's most people's experience in the arts. And I just thought Blaze Foley, somehow I was like, wow, he's the perfect, you know, vehicle to tell a more true biopic. One, because like you said, I find them often extremely lazy because they have a great central performance, because there's this very interesting human being at the center of which we already know a lot about. So a lot of the work of the actor has already been done. All they have to do is imitate this other person. They don't have to do any discovery. And part of what I wanted from Ben Dickey was I cast a real musician, a guy who has cried real salty tears over the way his dreams have been treated by the music industry.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And he has something to say about that. You're not going to watch some reheated meal. You know, he has something to offer you about his love of music and his love of Blaze. And he's lived this life.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't want him to impersonate Blaze. And the great thing about when Blaze isn't famous, nobody would know anyway, right. Even if you did.
Yeah.
You have to make, I want you to put your blood into the movie. Use Blaze's music. Blaze gave us his music. That's where he lives. That's where we'll be true to the man by honoring the music.
Yeah.
Now let's honor the spirit of what's vital about an artist's life where their dreams don't come true.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about how you settled on kind of the framing device, and that makes it sound a little more mechanical than it is in this film. There's nothing mechanical about it, but honoring the music. The music is really not just the soundtrack. It's what holds the entire narrative together.
It holds it all together. I call it a country western opera, you know, which is, you know, a good musical. It tells the story of the characters through song. So I studied Blaze's music and figured, like, what's the character inside this song? How could this song speak for the movie? And I had this idea that when people die, there's this kind of fight over the narrative. You know, I've seen it happen over. What's the story?
Mm-hmm.
And the wife tells one story and the best friend tells another story and the person who worked with them tells another story. And often they don't match. You know, they don't describe the same human mm-hmm. being. And I think a lot about this, about past, present, and future. And that was my idea. Like, what if I made a movie where it really isn't one narrative? It's this braid of the three of them. There's the past, there's the present, and the future, and they're always touching and affecting each other. And what if I could tell Blaze's life posthumously, the way people fight over the narrative after they're gone, the way the narrative is being created in the moment, and the way that, you know, the female point of view, his lover's mm-hmm. point of view, his point of view, how they're all dancing off of each other. And I kind of just, that was my device.
Yeah. Another touch that I really loved with the movie, and it's something I can't really recall ever seeing before, is the way you show us characters in life happening outside of the point of view of that main character, right? So we get these little snippets sometimes where we follow the angry guy in from his truck as he then gets into a fight with Blaze, and then the guy whose job it is to clean up the remnants of the beer bottle from that fight, and then we follow him outside a little bit. And it did reinforce for me anyway the idea that everybody's the star of their own story, right?
What I didn't want to do is make another movie that deifies the individual.
Yeah.
That, oh, isn't it sad Blaze wasn't discovered? You know what? Blaze lived his life, and there are Blazes around you all the time. That's what I wanted to do. It's like, who's the waitress at the club where Blaze Foley works? I bet she's a musician too. Or what does she think about this song? What does the busboy think about it? What is the other person on the bus mm-hmm. sitting about it? Hopefully what you take away from that is not that Blaze is special, but that we are special.
I do really love that touch, as I said. And you mentioned Born to Be Blue earlier. One of my favorite films of that year, actually. Your performance, I think, was my favorite of the year as Chet Baker. And I do want to ask you about one scene in particular. You'll know which one here. My apologies for quoting myself. But on the show, when I talked about that scene in my list of the year's best, I said that it starts with those familiar notes to My Funny Valentine on his horn, then switches to vocals. He's there to prove he can play the trumpet the way he used to play. He mostly sings instead. And he's not a particularly good singer, but he commits to the performance. He connects with the music. He internalizes not just the words, but the soul of the song, and then expresses it in his own idiosyncratic way, which is what great artists do. And it's melancholy and haunting and gorgeous and weird and vulnerable. And I could go on about that performance and that scene.
Thanks.
What I want to ask is how the performance scenes, that one in particular maybe, and that entire experience of playing Chet Baker did ultimately inform your making of this movie.
There was a review I read of Chet's singing that gave me real inspiration, which was that it wasn't even somebody singing. It was the memory of someone having sung already. No sooner had it come out of his mouth, and there was this detachment that he didn't sing well. You know, he didn't, like Nina Simone
right.
sings well.
Yeah.
Louis Armstrong sings well. He communicates. And he communicates something genuine, that there's a genuine loneliness there and there's a genuine fragility
yes.
there. And he really liked to sing, but that he really liked to sing because he was so worried about his teeth that he wanted to give his horn playing a break. I found that so interesting.
Yeah.
It's kind of like Bob Fosse. As it was this amazing dancer. And then as you study him, you realize, oh, he had a lot of problems with his legs. He was pigeon-toed. And he developed, because he wasn't as good a dancer as he wanted, he developed this real instep move that people found really sexy and cool. But it came from trying to hide
yeah.
that he couldn't go out, you know? And I find it's this thing as a parent all the time, you're trying to say, don't be scared of what makes you unique. It's actually what makes you beautiful. And that's why when I was like, you know what? I wouldn't normally think I could play this jazz musician, but because his secret was actually an actor's secret, which is you have to actually just show him how scared you are.
Yeah.
And then it can work. And that I thought I could do.
Well, I use the word commits there. And talking about commitment to a performance, maybe what I appreciate most about you as an actor is your level of commitment. I was talking with our producer, Sam, about this, that we never doubt that you are 100% all the way in on whatever it is that you're engaged in, whether it's life or whether it's art. Do you think that commitment, the act of committing to something, is a choice you make, or is it an instinct? Is that just who you are?
Some of us are predisposed to certain things, And some of us, our fears and our insecurities are encouraged by life.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes we have people, I find confidence extremely fragile, you know?
Yeah.
And the difference between somebody who's good at something and somebody who's great at something often is confidence. And in one person, it can leave. We see it in sports all the time. A guy's on a hitting streak, you know, and he can't miss.
Mm-hmm.
And then that confidence is the talent, the body, the molecules, the parents, the practice. It's all the same. But where's that magic confidence and where does it come from? And so commitment, I think, a lot of confidence can come in from two places. One is experience, and another is commitment. There's a line actually in the movie Blaze about confidence, because it's a mystery to me how we, when we're at our worst, it's usually because we aren't confident.
Mm-hmm. You
know, when we lie to somebody, when we're hateful to somebody we care about, or maybe somebody we just met, even, you know, something is. We're letting the worst parts of ourselves lead. And Ben Dickey, the lead actor, has this thing that he, you know, one of the things that gives you confidence is knowing that you're alive. Simply knowing that you actually have air in your lungs and that your heart is beating right now and that it actually won't forever.
Yeah.
It actually puts your finger on something very tangibly real. Like a sun, you know, one thing that I think that people love about a sunrise or a sunset is it marks this day. Unlike this is really happening. And from that, you realize that life is passing and that this, you can't waste these moments. And for some mysterious reason, confidence can be drawn there because you can see the melodramas, the little things that shake your confidence aren't real. Oh, she won't like me. Maybe I'll fail. Failure feels so much better if you know you were committed.
Yeah.
It's just true.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think that's the sports fan in me always. I love... You don't ever have to feel bad about losing a game if you gave it your all, if you leave it all in the field. You know, it's an expression I heard watching an athlete once. Somebody said, there's no quitting that guy. And I thought, what a great expression. Permission to fail. You know, I remember one of my – Richard Linklater directing me one time said, you know, what he didn't like about a certain actor he was talking about is that something happened during the day and he gave himself permission to fail. That was the reason why I wasn't going to do a good job today. And he said, you just got to never give yourself permission. You're going to fail.
Mm-hmm.
We're all going to fail all the time. That's part of living. But don't give yourself permission. You know, go down swinging.
Absolutely.
And, you know, I try to do that even if – it's one of the things that is lousy about the film business. If you're a painter, for example, and you're painting a picture, and you get about halfway through it, and you're going to go, this is not going to work. You stop, and you put it in the – you know, garage or whatever, you paint over the canvas, you wait 2 years till you have the idea to fix it. When you're halfway through a movie, sometimes you know it's not going to work. You know, you just know it. You feel it in your body. But you got to finish it because all these people are being paid and you're like, damn it, I know this isn't going to work. And you can't do. You know, I actually heard Paul Schrader speak about this so beautifully. He really believes that a big part of cinema is casting. You know, and if you cast it wrong, you figure it out about 2 weeks into the shoot, and it's just over.
Huh.
And when you cast it right, you can't, you know, then everything starts working all by itself. And that's the way I've come to feel that way.
Yeah. You mentioned Linklater, and I want to talk about him here. We have just a little bit of time left. I kind of hate this trend on social media of parents sharing funny or poignant things their precocious kids supposedly just said, but now I'm going to be guilty of it.
Yeah.
I got a text from my daughter, Sophie, completely out of the blue recently, and it said this: it is 2 weeks from my 14th birthday. This is exactly the age Juliet fell in love with Romeo. Now, she was reading Shakespeare in school, but my first thought was, shoot me. You know, I'm not prepared for any of this. But my second thought was, I think she's ready for Before Sunrise.
Oh, she is.
And I'm really now eager to watch that film with her. So I want you, Ethan Hawke, to guide me. Should we dive
thing
into
for
that?
You to say.
Yeah.
First of all, you know, everybody does their own thing, but there's this thing that goes around with men that they're supposed to be scared of their daughter's sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
And it's like somehow they think it's a good quality. I remember when my oldest, when she was turning 16, you better keep those guys away. Keep a shotgun at the door or something. And I was like, you know what? I'm going to give Maya permission to be her own shotgun.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And if you act all scared of her sexuality, then how is she supposed to feel? You know? And There's a great movie that Kris Kristofferson plays a dad in. It's called A Soldier's Daughter Never Cries. It's written by James Jones, and Chris plays this old war veteran and writer. And I saw it really affected me because Chris, just his character, just loves his daughter and gives her permission to be 100% human being, meaning you are a sexual person. Juliet did fall in love with Romeo, and you know what? It's beautiful. And is she prepared to fall in love? No. Were you? No. Nobody is.
Right.
You're never going to do it all right, but you can give her confidence.
Yeah.
Confidence to know that she's in charge, and she doesn't need to be scared of him. She doesn't need a dad with a shotgun behind her. She can handle herself, and she can go have a good time.
Yeah.
And she can make mistakes, and she can recover from them. You know,
yeah.
All of that's this idea of innocence and this idea that we're not allowed to make mistakes. And that, you know, we are allowed to make mistakes. Mm-hmm. We're allowed to grow up. And if we don't, then we're just going to live in a little tiny, tiny glass world. And I've given my daughter permission to make a big fool of herself if she wants.
Yeah.
And to break some hearts and to get her heart broken.
Yep.
And I think I was really, I got to tell you, one of the best moments of my life was Maya was about 18, so just a year or so ago. And one of her friends told her that Before Sunrise was a really good film. She's like, my dad's film? And they were like, yeah. And she watched it, and she loved it. And she had all these interesting things to say about it. And I was so pleased to know that we had a goal when we were making that movie to have no pop culture references. We wanted it to be able to not be, is it 1970? Is it 2010? You know, we made it in whatever year it was, 94, 95 or whatever. But we wanted it to be able to float through time because the way you feel when you walk through an old European city, you almost feel like a ghost, or because the past, present, future, when things are so old around you, it feels a little different than it does here in America.
Yeah.
So I say, show your daughter Before Sunrise.
Can't wait.
And I hope she likes it, and tell her she's right. She is the age of Juliet, and things are happening, and it's for real.
Yeah,
man.
We're going to do that soon. And to her credit, when I made some non-evolved comment back to her, she replied, reminding me how young I was when I met her mother. And
how old were you?
I was 16.
Wow. So there you go.
Put me in my place.
It's on.
Very quickly.
And, you know, tell her to go see Romeo and Juliet, too, because she'll learn a lot from that.
For sure.
That play teaches you a lot.
Yeah. Okay. We're going to end with the film spotting five here. Five rapid fire questions.
Hit me.
Last movie you saw in the theater other than your own?
I don't know what the last one I saw was. The one that jumps to my mind is I saw the 25th anniversary of Malcolm X in Brooklyn with a full house. And it goes to show how much you can't watch, how important it is going to the movies, because I remember being told that movie was too long. When you see Denzel's performance in that movie with the music blaring and the crowd laughing.
I've never seen it with an audience. I can't imagine.
It's better than a fireworks display, you know? I mean, it's what cinema is supposed to be. So that floored me. That was the most recent one I remember.
Okay, is there another one?
I saw Claire Denis recently, in her film with Juliette Binoche, which was also
Let the Sun Shine In. Yeah.
Yeah, which this woman, Juliette Binoche,
is the greatest, right?
She really is first ballot Hall of Famer, man. She just keeps doing it.
Without a doubt. A movie then that you revisited recently, not on the big screen, just threw it in the DVD player, if anyone uses DVD players anymore, the iPad.
You know, when Sam Shepard died, I had to watch Paris, Texas again. And God, you know, I didn't realize how much that movie had. If you watch Blaze, which you know, I watched it a lot. I didn't realize how much that movie was in my psyche.
Really?
And what a staggering work of art that movie is.
Yeah.
It's just such a beautiful movie.
That's one I need to revisit very
badly. It's really worth it.
An underrated movie, new or old. Maybe one that you just love more than anyone else you know.
An underrated movie. Girls Just Want to Have Fun?
Yeah.
Okay. I showed that movie. It's an 80s, you know, Sarah Jessica Parker, who else is it? Helen Hunt. Yeah, and she's amazing in it. It's a totally corny, silly movie, but you want to have fun with your girls, watch that movie.
There you go. So let's see if you can pull another title here. Just a random movie you love.
I was wondering why nobody talks about Buffalo 66 anymore.
Yeah, we just brought it up on the last show we taped before this interview we did.
Well,
I
want
to talk to you about this.
It.
We did our top five classic rock moments in movies. Obviously, yeah. Dazed and Confused was a big part
sure.
of that show. But the use of a Yes song at the end of Buffalo 66 was an honorable mention
for
me.
That's a terrific, terrific movie. I really liked the film Bellflower came out a few years ago. That was a really remarkable film. I love... you know, Schenectady, New York really holds a place in my mind.
Mine too.
Yeah. Those, you know, what's popping in my brain is really strong films that people that haven't seen as much.
Yeah, for sure.
You know, another, this is totally self-serving, but I don't mean it to be. I did this movie called Predestination that a lot of people haven't seen. And inside of it, Sarah Snook gives a performance. She plays a transgender person inside a genre movie. And I mean, if it were a little indie movie, people would talk about it like they would recognize what a great performance it is. But I think because it's in a genre movie, great performances get lost that way. And she's incredible in that movie.
No, great, great stuff. Last one, your favorite book about movies or movie making?
A Life by Kazan.
Yeah.
That's the one. Linkletter says this, and I agree. He thinks it should be required reading. That if you're serious, you know, if you have a kid, a son or daughter out there who's getting interested in making movies or acting in them, or you yourself are serious about it, you know, Kazan had a big life and he experienced a lot sociopolitically.
Mm-hmm.
He worked with, you know, the last great movement in acting, Marlon Brando, James Dean, Strasberg, group theater. He really touched on all this. And he's one of the very few who excelled at a high level in the theater and in movies. And when you listen to the way he talks about acting, you're like, oh, it's actually no surprise that he blew up James Dean, Marlon Brando, Montgomery. I mean, like, he changed it. I never had anybody in 30 years of acting talk to me about acting the way that Alia Kazan talked about acting in his book. And it makes you realize why all these British actors are so damn good. They treat their profession with a tremendous amount of respect. And we have this whole cult of celebrity around things where it just confuses things.
Mm-hmm.
And it really confuses young people, I think.
Yeah. There's so much more we could get to. We did our top five Linklater scenes a while back, I think When Everybody Wants Some came out. And I just looking at that list again realized that four of my five scenes had you in it.
Oh,
and maybe another time we'll be able to go through those.
Look, I'm going to have to do my favorite that I've ever been in is talking Julie to get off the train and before sunrise.
Oh, yeah?
You know, telling her that she was going to be a time traveler and I was going to make her feel better about her present marriage by revealing to her what a loser I was.
Yeah. Well, that's a great scene. That film is filled with them. Thank you so much for your time, Ethan. Best of luck with Blaze. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
So listen, here's the deal. This is what we should do. You should get off the train with me here in Vienna and come check out the town.
What?
Come on. It'll be fun.
What would we do?
I don't know. All I know is I have to catch an Austrian Airlines flight tomorrow morning at 9:30, and I don't really have enough money for a hotel, so I was just going to walk around, and it'd be a lot more fun if you came with me. And if I turn out to be some kind of psycho, you know, you just get on the next train.
My thanks again to Ethan Hawke, and I know we've referenced it a couple times already, but that moment in the interview where he basically turned into an Ethan Hawke character and offered me that parenting advice, that's a top five moment for me in the history of the show as we approach episode 700. It was just surreal.
Oh, I'm sure. And how refreshing to hear someone else say that, because I don't have daughters quite that age, the same as his yet, but we've started to go through the dances at school, the dating thing, and I've never had that instinct either, the grab the shotgun protective instinct. And to hear someone else kind of articulate that and say that it's not to be a man, to be a father, it doesn't require that sort of attitude. It just never struck me as something that would be healthy in any way either. Mm. Now, I suppose you get one wrong guy and you might change your philosophy a little bit. But yeah, that was really cool to see him go off on that little diversion there.
Well, I think maybe you're more sophisticated than me. You're up there with Ethan Hawke. I'm just as guilty, I think, of a double standard sometimes with daughters versus sons and that whole protect their innocence nonsense. But for me, really, when I said shoot me, when Sophie sent that to me, the majority of my trepidation, and I'm sure you do feel this, it was just anxiety over her growing up.
Yeah, that's
that's really
thing.
What it is. She's just ushering me into that phase of adulthood a little quicker than my boys are.
Oh, man. Coming across old photos of preschool, first grade, second grade years, that's just getting harder and harder and harder.
Yeah. I did watch Before Sunrise with Sophie. In fact, just this weekend here, getting ready for this show, I suggested that I would do it after telling Ethan Hawke I was going to do it. I couldn't
follow through,
of course. And, oh, man, what a relief. She loved it. She loved the movie. She also wanted to see the notes I was taking. I was jotting down little things on my phone from time to time. She was spying my notes. And as annoying as that was, and I had to stop her, I, of course, loved the fact that she was so curious about how I was processing the movie and the fact that she's just thinking about processing movies.
No, I refuse that. Those documents cannot be seen by the public. So when my kids ask that, it's a no-go.
I promised her. I promised her that I would tell her what I was furiously typing. But he's absolutely right, watching that movie again. It is a timeless film, for me, a timeless masterpiece. And she did say to me immediately afterwards that she wanted to share it with one of her really good friends because that friend is notorious for not being into romantic stuff. And Sophie felt like if she couldn't go for Before Sunrise, then she really was hopeless.
Yeah.
Because that for her sort of embodied everything she thinks of when she thinks of romance. And of course, I love that reaction to it.
It's a great one to give to somebody who's allergic to conventional trumped up romances because this is completely the opposite. It's the naturalistic, authentic kind. Yeah, that's a great idea to send it to someone like that.
His film Spotting 5 was great as well. And he mentioned Predestination. That's a film of his that he really thinks is underrated. I've seen him in a few other places bring up that sci-fi movie, one that he actually sees as of a pair with Gattaca because the filmmakers who made it, the Spierig brothers, saw it as a pair in a way with Gattaca. That's one of the reasons he thinks that he was cast in it based on a Robert Heinlein short story. Sarah Snook, I did catch an interview today where he said that her performance in that film, and really it's almost her movie more than it is Ethan Hawke's movie, it's one of his favorite performances he's ever acted opposite. And I think maybe her performance is the biggest reason I would say that sci-fi film was worth seeing. It's one of those mind-bender time travel movies, and I'm not sure at all coheres, but it's worth a visit. It definitely is.
And I know it has some strong fans among listeners because when we were fishing on Twitter for suggestions for a top five list, someone came on pretty hard for a scene from Predestination.
So we've touched on the interview, but I'm curious for a few of your thoughts on the movie we talked about, Josh Blaze, a movie I did go for quite a bit for all the reasons you heard in our discussion, including how unconventional it is as a biopic, the focus on the music, which I also happen to enjoy, those little detours it takes in terms of its focus on some of those side characters, but also in what Ethan Hawke was describing as far as trying to reckon with the way biographies, true stories, or really any story has various owners. I thought that was an insightful approach to take to the material.
He touched on maybe the thing I liked best about it was, and he described it better than I could when he was talking about past, present, and future and trying to hold those all at once. Mm-hmm. And one way Blaze does that is to just break away from a conventional narrative moment that you would expect in a linear biopic and give us an image, almost an impressionistic image. The one that comes to mind is of Blaze walking beneath an underpass, I think. In one sequence, he's just by himself. In another one, he is with Sybil. And I think there are two moments in the film where that comes back and just interrupts, just breaks a regular routine narrative sequence in a way that does play with that conventionality of the biopic, which, I'm not always a big fan of that structure. So anytime it's tweaked like that, I'm going to appreciate it.
Blaze is out now in limited release. It's opening here in Chicago on September 21st. For more information about the movie, visit blazethemovie.com. If you want to revisit that interview with Ethan Hawke or any other interviews from the show's history, just go to filmspotting.net. There is an interviews link right at the top of the page.
So where do listeners stand on Ethan Hawke's career, at least the non-Richard Linklater films? All will be revealed next with the results of the Film Spotting poll. Then Keith Phipps from The Next Picture Show stops by to share his favorite Ethan Hawke moments. The Film Spotting Top 5 is coming up. Stay with us.
I'm going down to the Greyhound station, gonna get a ticket to ride. Gonna find that lady with two or three kids and sit down by her side. Ride till the sun comes up and down around me about two or three times. Smoking cigarettes in the last seat.
try to hide myself from the people I meet and get along with it all. Go down what people say, y'all. Sing a song with a friend. Change the shape of a man. And get back in the game. Start playing again. I'd like to stay, but I might have to go to start over.
Predators. They exploit weakness, tracks its prey, like a game, seems to enjoy it.
That's not a predator, that's a sports hunter.
Well, we took a vote. Predator's cooler, right? Yeah.
We took a vote to Josh, and The Predator is the movie we're going to review on next week's show.
Yeah.
Nicely done.
I love how this is a show where you get the warm and fuzzy parenting interview with Ethan Hawke, and here I am dropping expletives. F-bombs.
For the uninitiated, The Predator is part of the Predator franchise. Yeah, you do. 1987's Predator, no, The, with Arnold, Carl Weathers, and Jesse Ventura. I can't believe we're breaking this down. I don't even care. Directed by diehards John McTiernan.
The people who do care know all this, so we really can't skip it.
So then there was what? Predator 2 in the 90s, no Arnold, but Danny Glover, Bill Paxton, and Gary Busey. Then there was a long break, The Predator's Return, plural, in 2010, Adrian Brody, Topher Grace, Lawrence Fishburne, and that one, Predator.
It's not The Predators. In 2010, it was just
Predators.
Predators.
I know.
And it's very good.
So you
say. Let's reiterate that.
But you also like to diss the first one, so who knows where you're going to come down on The Predator, written and directed by Shane Black, who is responsible for The Nice Guys and Kiss Kiss Bang Bang. He's got some 80s action movie pedigree as the screenwriter of the original Lethal Weapon, along with The Last Action Hero. He also acted in the original Predator. So, Josh, please tell me and listeners why we're watching and reviewing The Predator.
I don't remember.
It was the best
option.
It's
on the schedule.
Yeah, it's on the schedule.
It was months ago. Yeah,
I think you push for it.
Sure. I'm interested. I'm genuinely interested in this movie, and Black being involved makes it more of a curiosity. I think the cast is interesting.
It's really
Trevante
good.
Rhodes from Moonlight's going to be there. Keegan-Michael Key, Olivia Munn, Sterling K. Brown, and Jake Busey. So yeah, let's see what The Predator has to offer.
Okay. We will see what it has to offer next week on the show. And we've been searching for a top five. We thank everyone on Twitter who replied to Josh at Larson on Film or me at Film Spotting and shared some different ideas. We ignored all of them, it seems.
There was some good stuff on there. The one I thought about was maybe jungle scenes. And then I watched the trailer for The Predator, and I'm not sure there's a lot of jungle in it, so maybe not a great tie-in.
And I would just say Herzog, and the show would be over.
Well, you could go that route. But yeah, so we did read all those suggestions. But then Sam came up with something that I think, little off the beaten path,
yeah,
but I think could be fun to do.
What we wanted to do, or at least what we initially threw out as a trio, was could we revisit 80s franchises of any kind? TV, music, wrestling, doesn't matter. And there's a nice tie-in, of course, with Jesse the Body in Predator. And revive those. How would we power rank those, sort of like we did with the Chris's? Or if we were just going to take some of those movie franchises and we're doing a variation on that, essentially, with this one. Are we not? Action power ranking?
No, that's how 80s. I understand it. Because
okay.
I don't know, but I don't care to have any other 80s franchises rebooted.
Okay.
So there was an investment issue
with that.
You don't
want
that.
To see the new Die Hard or Lethal Weapon. You'll just take the ones we got.
Yeah, I think so.
Okay.
But would it be interesting to look back at the ones we got, those signature 80s action franchises, and power rank them? Choose five and have a debate, as
really
we did about
it.
As we did about the movie Chris's, which got a little heated, which one deserves to be on top? Are you in?
I'm in.
You're in.
I'm in for now until I start forming my list, and then
you don't have to
throw out other options.
You just look at them, and this is an instinctive one. This is not one you'll overthink.
I can't overthink
it. You don't have to go back and research them all.
Oh.
You don't have to watch all of the Lethal Weapons.
Then I'm out.
You just look at them. You think about your memories of them. Where are you going to go? Who's on top? I'm pretty much done, so we can do this right now.
A prerequisite here, Josh, is that we do have to agree on the five best action films of the 80s.
Yes.
So, I mean, we could be here for weeks.
Yeah, that's true. And we have 1 week, so we'll see what happens.
If you have any better suggestions or if you have a pick for the best action film of the 80s, we would love to hear from you. You can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net. You could also leave us an audio file, and we might play that on the show, feedback@filmspotting.net, or call us and leave a voicemail, 312-264-0744. Movie passes. We love to give them away when we have them here on the show. Usually advanced screening passes, sometimes run of engagement passes, so you have some options during the movie's run here in the city. Visit filmspotting.net/events is where you can see the screenings and enter to win.
What we've got right now at filmspotting.net/events are admit two passes to a Monday, September 10th screening of White Boy Rick. This is an 80s set true crime drama starring Matthew McConaughey and Jennifer Jason Leigh.
Jennifer Jason Leigh not discussed on last week's show, but a lot of other actors and filmmakers were. I think it was a record for us, or at least for you, Josh. You discussed five films. I was just an observer for two of those.
Stepped out for a little bit.
Yeah. We had a Golden Brick nominee bonanza with reviews of Madeline's Madeline, John McEnroe in The Realm of Perfection, and Night Comes On. And, oh yeah, Josh threw in a few thoughts about The Happy Time Murders, which a listener wrote us today with the subject line, The Crappy Time Murderers.
Yeah.
That was his feedback on your review, Josh.
I think it was on the movie, not on my review.
True.
Thank you very much.
True. That one not going to get a Golden Brick nomination. The other film that right now is certainly a strong contender for the award, and we opened that show with a review of it, the great new documentary, Minding the Gap, produced by Chicago's Kartemquin Films. I didn't promote this on last week's show. Don't be mad at me, Chicago listeners, but it came together quick, and I knew that by the time I teased it in the episode, the event itself would already have passed. Last Friday night at its Chicago premiere, Bing Liu, the director, was there. The editor, Joshua Altman, was there, and one of the film's producers, Diane Kwan. Kartemquin asked me to moderate the Q&A after that premiere screening. It was a real honor for me, considering how much I love the film. Great crowd, really good questions, and we have the audio from that. We might just share it in a future Film Spotting episode.
Yeah, nice. I wasn't there myself, so I'd like to hear that.
Another plug for the Gene Siskel Film Center. One Sings, the Other Doesn't is going to be starting a run soon, and our listeners may remember this from our fairly recent Agnes Varda marathon, Varda of Faces Places fame, Cleo from 5 to 7, so many other great films, including Vagabond. This is actually a restoration of this movie. The reason I really want to highlight it is because it's a film that's really hard to see. Listeners may recall that I think we only talked about it, had a chance to talk about it, because we were in partnership with Mubi, and it was available on their service, and only on their service. It's a really hard movie to find, at least as I recall. And now, at least our Chicago listeners will have a chance to see it. And you can go to filmspotting.net/marathons before or after that screening if you are so inclined to check it out and hear our conversation about it.
I think that was one of the discoveries. I mean, we discovered a lot in that marathon, but that was a film I had not been familiar with at all and ended up really, really liking. As a matter of fact, I don't know if you remember this, but we give awards at the end of each marathon, and we both chose a different moment to give the favorite scene / moment award to from One Sings, the Other Doesn't.
That's true. And I think at least one of us had one of those lead performances as our favorite lead performance as well. It's a film about the friendship of two women that spans a couple decades, and it is Varda's most explicitly feminist film, and it's one we recommend. We will link to more information about that run in our show notes at filmspotting.net. We'll also have some information there about another great event happening here. We're just trying to make all of our listeners around the world jealous, basically, that they don't live in Chicago.
Exactly.
Hopefully it's working, but the 70mm Film Festival is coming back to Chicago's Music Box Theater. Starts September 14th, ends on the 27th. Tickets are on sale now. I know we highlighted some of the titles last week on the show. One of the big ones that I'm excited to see for the first time on the big screen is David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia. We're going to see that, I think, on Sunday.
The 16th. That sounds right.
It's a Sunday.
Yeah.
And
I've got my tickets already.
That Friday show that follows it, we're going to have a Sacred Cow review of Lawrence of Arabia. So even if you can't get to it in 70 mil, you might want to visit it or revisit it and participate in that discussion. More information about the Music Box 70mm Film Festival will be in our show notes as well at filmspotting.net.
So along with all that Golden Brick talk we did last week, we also made some time for Massacre Theater. That's where we perform a scene from a famous film and you get a chance to win a Film Spotting t-shirt. So riding home from the recording, Adam, I think it was when I got home.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't look at my phone when I'm driving. I saw your tweet You said, what am I supposed to do when the voice that would have made this week's Massacre Theater 100% funnier only came out when I was in the car after recording?
Yeah, and I copied you and I copied Sam, and you guys had no sympathy for me whatsoever.
No. If you rehearse, for one thing, if you're really worried about this, put some effort into it,
yeah,
and rehearse.
I failed.
You didn't.
I didn't rehearse until post.
But I do love the idea of you riding all the way home.
Yeah. I had a good 5 minutes of funny voices, solo funny voices in my car. And apparently I should have gone for the imitation based on the number of entries. The film spotting hat, not brimming.
Yeah, I was
not brimming this week.
I was a little worried about the title pick. You know, I said this was one I wasn't familiar with. I don't know if it's necessarily a famous film, but...
No.
It was a fun scene to do.
Okay.
That's all that matters to me.
Yeah, I agree. And it would have been even more fun if I had gone for the funny voice. But I didn't. If you want to hear the non-funny voice version of Massacre Theater, we're going to give you just a little taste.
Tell me, how do you see Richard? Mr. Macho, is that it?
No, look, I don't think the guy is a linebacker for the Chicago Bears, but let's not throw away one of his prime motivations.
Oh, and what's that?
He wants to hump Lady Anne.
So since you put in all that rehearsal time, let's hear it. What do you got? Let's hear the finished product.
No chance.
Come on.
No, you guys didn't care last week. You were mocking me and
just give us he wants to hump Lady Anne. That's
no,
all we want.
No.
A couple words.
Nope.
Oh my gosh.
I'm gonna take another week to prepare. Maybe.
That sounds about right.
Maybe I'll do it for next week's show, Josh. You have that to look forward to. In the meantime, if you know what film we massacred, email the movie's title along with your name and location to feedback@filmspotting.net. Your deadline is Monday, September 10th.
I'll never understand what possessed my mother to put her faith in God's hands rather than those of her local geneticist. 10 fingers, 10 toes, that's all that used to matter. Not now. Now, only seconds old, the exact time and cause of my death was already known.
The man of the hour, Ethan Hawke, there with some of the voiceover that opens 1997's Gattaca, written and directed by Andrew Niccol. Gattaca was notably not one of the options we gave you a couple weeks ago when we asked this confusingly worded poll question, though Gattaca was, Josh, one of the movies I watched as homework for this week's top five. Spoiler alert, it's not going to make my top five, but you weren't wrong. Pretty good little sci-fi flick.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I found after skimming through a bunch of scenes as well that the movie overall probably holds up, but a representation of the best of Hawke. He's good in it. Don't get me wrong. And there's some good scenes in there. But when you're trying to narrow down to five, didn't make the cut for me either.
Okay. The question. Yes. What is the best Ethan Hawke performance? But we're going best non-Richard Linklater, non-2018 performance. Why did we do that? Because we thought it would be more fun if we didn't let people go kind of the default route, the cliche route, even if it's possibly the correct route, and go with Jesse from one of the Before movies, or maybe you would go with his performance as the dad in Boyhood. And of course, First Reform, very vivid in the minds of everyone who has seen that film earlier this year or who just caught up with it recently. I know there's a fair amount of Oscar buzz around it, so we wanted to go with maybe some things off the beaten path, Josh. The options were Todd Anderson in Dead Poets Society, Troy Dyer in Reality Bites, Hamlet in Michael Amorata's Hamlet, his Oscar-nominated turn as Jake in Training Day, Hank in Sidney Lumet's Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, or some other Ethan Hawke performance that isn't in a Richard Linklater movie and isn't from this year.
Well, his Hamlet came in last place with 4%. Troy Dyer from Reality Bites got 7% of the vote. His early turn in Dead Poets Society received 13% of the vote. Hank in the Sidney Lumet film received 17% of the vote. And other here, rarely do we see other this high, probably a reflection of that Gattaca love. That got 24% of the vote, but that means that the winner was Jake in Training Day with 33% of the vote.
Billy Ray Bruton writes, this was an easy choice, Vincent Freeman in Gattaca. It's one of the most underrated sci-fi films ever, in part due to Hawke's complicated and nuanced performance as a man who will do anything it takes to travel to the stars. It's really a simple story that Hawke transforms into something revelatory and entirely human. It also features one of my favorite brother relationships ever depicted on screen. I'm just going to assume that everyone who chooses other in this poll is doing it for Gattaca. And yes, Josh, a fair assumption there by Billy Ray, because Vincent Freeman in Gattaca was by far the option that got the most other votes, the most write-ins from listeners.
There you go. Brian Quinn said, there's no doubt that Training Day is Denzel's film. We can hardly take our eyes off him. But as Denzel sizzles, Hawk wriggles. With a catalog of giddy ticks, Hawk's limbs flutter and flick and almost undercut Washington's swagger. It's this clash of physicality that underpins the tension of the film, and what a film it is.
Jose Maldonado writes in, praising a film that I still haven't seen, Josh, I'm throwing in my vote for Hawk's performance in one of my favorite horror slash thrillers of the decade, Sinister. Hawk plays Ellison Oswald, a true crime author who moves his family into a home where a horrific set of murders have occurred in hopes of getting inspired to write his latest novel and recapture his former literary glory. As the events of the movie unfold and he gets deeper into his investigation, we see layer upon layer of Ellison's seen-it-all attitude get peeled away as his stubbornness to move forward has him completely in over his head. Hawk masterfully carries us through, and what we're left with chills me to the bone every time. Fantastic movie and a great performance.
I'll have to take your word for that too, Jose. Tom Kuzmarskis said, my choice for the best Hawk performance is as jazz great Chet Baker in Born to be Blue.
Hear, hear.
It's a criminally underseen film, and Hawk's delicate performance as a musician struggling with personal demons while trying to make his music is amazing. A great piece of art about making art that I hear has influenced Hawk's own film Blaze.
And indeed, we did hear Ethan Hawke say that in my interview, and I was very surprised and happy to see that Born to be Blue was the second most popular write-in vote, Josh, a movie that I really did feel was overall underseen, probably is, in comparison to a lot of Hawk's other films. It was a Golden Brick candidate for us the year it came out. Daniel Shakevich wrote in, my vote for Other may be a cheat, but I wanted to make sure that Hawk's genre performances were given some recognition. From horror entries like The Purge and Sinister to sci-fi flicks like Predestination, Hawk shows up in a lot of movies. Not all of them are great, but one thing is consistent. Hawk's commitment is complete in any role he inhabits. Daniel and I obviously sharing a brain on that, as commitment was one of the topics of our conversation as well.
One more note here comes from Darren. Because there's no such thing as a guilty pleasure, I can't pass up the opportunity to praise 1998's Great Expectations. Alfonso Cuarón and Emmanuel Lubezki helped make this a joy to look at throughout. But Ethan Hawke as Finn, by offering such heart, makes this one of my favorites of the 90s. I believe his Finn as an artist. I believe his confused affection for Gwyneth Paltrow's Estella. I believe his awkwardness as a teenager and, playing the older Finn, I believe his discomfort and shame in his class. I even believe the emotions in his narration. It all works. Thank you, Film Spotting, for giving Ethan Hawke the recognition he deserves.
So, Reality Bites is a film that I rewatched or watched. We may get into more of that here in the top five just over the weekend, getting ready for this show. And guess who pops up as the cinematographer of Reality Bites? Apparently his first Hollywood film.
Is it really Lubezki?
Lubezki.
First director he worked with was Ben Stiller.
Ben Stiller.
How about that?
Things worked out pretty good for Emmanuel Lubezki. Thanks to everyone who participated in that poll and shared such great feedback. That brings us to our new poll question. A couple weeks from now, we do have that Sacred Cow review of David Lean's Lawrence of Arabia plan. As we noted, it's playing with a new print at this year's 70mm Film Festival at the Music Box here in Chicago. It's one of the great historical movie epics, 3 hours and 36 minutes long. 3 hours and 36 minutes of Peter O'Toole's Baby Blues in the Desert.
I'm going to be in trouble. I think I told the kids it was only 3:10 or something
yeah,
like that.
I definitely didn't tell them over 3.5. But it got us thinking about more recent, if not quite as long, historical epics. Josh, can you do the honors of this question and the options if Sam and I are done wrangling over them?
Oh my goodness, I hope you're done.
I'm throwing in the towel. I'm throwing in the towel. I give up.
You're a good man because I threw it in way earlier than you.
Yeah.
What you have arrived at here.
Yes.
What is the best historical epic of the last 25 years? Is it Mel Gibson's Braveheart? It's from 1995. James Cameron's Titanic, Ridley Scott's Gladiator, Peter Weir's Master and Commander, or Alejandro González Iñárritu's The Revenant from 2015. All right. Do we want to share with the class all of the angst that went into this?
No.
Or should we just let them concentrate on the options?
Well, if we want to avoid reading all the comments that people write in telling us how flawed this question is, maybe we should give them a little bit. We are giving you the other option here.
That's
because
true.
Because you probably need it.
Okay.
Now, historical epics.
Oh, here we go.
Is in quotation marks because we are using it to describe movies and their attention to period detail. We're not necessarily suggesting that they were based on real people or events.
Got
I don't think
okay.
Leo DiCaprio was playing a real guy who got mauled by that bear. I could be wrong. Okay,
I'm with you so far.
But basically, big vistas, big performances in a historical setting, thinking a little bit more old-fashioned, big budget movie making in the tradition of movies like Lawrence of Arabia. And we did decide to leave out World War II movies. That's its own question. So there's no Saving Private Ryan or Schindler's List or The Thin Red Line or Dunkirk or Letters from Iwo Jima.
Yes. Okay. I think I got it. That's fairly clear.
Okay.
With all those caveats.
It can't be any more confusing and flawed than our last poll question.
No, I think we're improving.
We're just going to make this a tradition here on Film Spotting. If we haven't already, you can vote now at filmspotting.net. If you leave a comment, and we hope you do, unless it's a comment decrying how terrible the poll question is, please let us know where you're listening from.
So I'm going to try to keep things nice and simple here. The Film Spotting Top 5, Ethan Hawke Scenes, is next. Stay with us.
Just in time, you found me just in time. Before you came, my time's running low. I was lost, the losing dice were tossed. My bridges all were crossed, nowhere to go. Now you're here, and I know where I'm going. No more doubt or fear. Found my way, click, 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 click.
Stay in the couch.
Vicky, he will turn this place into a den of slack.
What the hell is your problem?
I have to work around here, and unfortunately, Troy, you are a master at the art of time suckage.
Oh, well, I'm sorry, Miss Poster Girl, for the workers' party, but until I get that toehold in the burger industry, I got a little time to suck. I'd rather check into a shelter than deal with her.
Okay, I know.
And there he is, your generation slacker cover boy, Ethan Hawke's Troy Dyer with Winona Ryder in that clip from 1994's Reality Bites. It is time for this week's Film Spotting Top 5 Ethan Hawke moments or scenes. You can go with whole scenes if you want. Joining us, Keith Phipps from many outlets, but also our sister podcast, The Next Picture Show. He is also the author of a recent article over at TheRinger.com, Generation Hawke. Ethan Hawke may never have asked to be a Gen X icon, but that designation and a career's worth of brilliant work has only made him better with age. Three new projects in 2018 confirm his greatness. We will talk about that with Keith and more as we welcome him on now. Thanks so much for coming back on Film Spotting, Keith.
Oh, I'm always happy to be here, guys.
So we really loved your piece.
Thank you.
We love having you on. We love having guests on for great top fives like this, but especially when you've already wrestled with the material as you have. We are eager to hear your insights. And I want to hear first just what prompted the piece. Is it just a matter of seeing some of these films that Ethan Hawke has coming out this year and also this reappraisal that has gone on with him over the past, what, 5 or 7 years and deciding to kind of reckon with that?
You know, it's really weird. I mean, I wasn't aware that there's going to be sort of this wave of Ethan Hawke press. I was just kind of looking for things to pitch various outlets as a freelance writer does. And, you know, he's been on my mind, obviously, because First Reformed, which is, you know, top one or two movies about that I've seen this year. It's fantastic. And he's great in it. And I've always, you know, I've kind of had like sort of an odd relationship with him because he's really someone at a certain point I did not look forward to seeing in movies. And a lot of it goes back to Reality Bites, which is a movie that I've never loved. I kind of appreciate now. I kind of resent it at the time because it was very much got the hard push, like, this is your generation on screen. Here you are. And I resented that, like a good Gen Xer. I resent it being late, like, whatever, man.
And the way Troy would,
right? Exactly. And like, you know, I came to realize it, a lot of it had to do with Troy. And like, yes, I read an interview with him where he talked about how, you know, people didn't like him because of that character. They found it pretentious. They thought it was really him. I'm like, well, that was kind of where I was.
Yeah.
And like, I hadn't really
me too.
Really thought that through. It's easy to do. It's not an easy character to love in many ways. And looking at the movie now, I kind of see that's maybe baked into the film a little bit more than I thought at the time. And maybe I'm just getting sentimental with my old age, but I kind of like, some of that's kind of right. It's mm-hmm. kind of how we process things.
I'll offer up a defense of his reality performance bias there when we get into the list.
And I don't think he's bad. And I just, we'll get into it. But, I hadn't really thought about the process, but I realized at a certain point, I went from not looking forward to seeing Ethan Hawke to Ethan Hawke being really one of my favorite actors. Mm-hmm. And I think that was probably before Sunset, which I'm sure we'll be talking about at some point. From a certain point on, it's like, oh, good, Ethan Hawke's in this. And it helps also that Linklater is a favorite filmmaker of mine, too.
Yes, me too.
It would be like liking John Ford, but not liking John Wayne. I'm sure there are people out there that feel that way, but I can't. That must be a very difficult way to live.
Well, there are a lot of reasons to recommend your piece, including your personal wrestling with Reality Bites and your connection to it. But one of the things I really love that we won't dive into now, because I think it might come up, but you trace a trajectory with him that I've never been able to articulate, which is this idea of him as a generational icon that comes up even to movies like First Reformed.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think we may get into that a little bit more. A little bit of background on Hawke. I don't know if you guys did the math, but I went to IMDb, 77 credits. There. If you exclude things like any TV appearances, shorts, music videos, documentaries, or kind of uncredited random stuff, and movies that haven't come out yet, you're left with 57 feature film performances. And even after cramming in four movies, three of which I had never seen before this past weekend, I've still only seen less than half. 26.
And the guy is how old again?
He's what, about 46?
47 or 48.
Okay, but still, that's like, that's a lot of work.
Yeah, he's been busy. And I do want to point out, before you judge me too harshly for having not seen 31 of his movies, those titles include movies like 24 Hours to Live, Maudie, Regression, 10,000 Saints, The Woman in the Fifth, and a 1998 movie called The Velocity of Gary. These are all movies I had never heard of before in my life, before looking at his IMDb credits. So I'm guessing I'm not alone. You guys might even be able to relate. And Keith, just like you, I had a period where I didn't think of Ethan Hawke being in a movie as something I look forward to at all. And I realized, looking at that list of credits, that the 90s in general were sort of a dead Ethan Hawke period for me. If you look at it, between Dead Poets Society in 1989 and Hamlet in 2000, he made 17 movies. And during that time, I only saw two of them. I saw Waterland on DVD because I was a huge Jeremy Irons fan, had nothing to do with Ethan Hawke. And of course, I saw Before Sunrise. I added two titles later by finally seeing Reality Bites and Gattaca just this past weekend. But otherwise, I only watched two of his films in the 90s. So he really wasn't a presence for me at all, really, in cinema until later into the 2000s.
Yeah, and it's interesting that Before Sunrise didn't launch him. Looking back on it now, you would think that would have been a moment or the moment for him. And maybe it was just the nature of that film becoming something of a beloved cult movie more than an instant success. Or maybe it's the fact that he's doing a variation on Troy there, a slightly expanded one, that there's, I think, many more elements to that character mm-hmm. than to Troy. But it's still a shade of that guy that was a turnoff for some people.
Mm-hmm.
I think he had some pretty big movies that didn't quite work out, like Snow Falling on Cedars, and then Great Expectations, which is a film I'd like to revisit because I like Cuarón so mm-hmm. much. But I remember that being a total whiff at the time. I remember it looked great, but just not, it felt like a really odd take on the material that didn't quite work out.
Yeah. A couple of reminders as we get into this top five. Usually we exclude movies that are in the Film Spotting Pantheon. Those are ineligible, typically, but with these kind of career retrospectives, we do count them. So the Before trilogy in the Pantheon, but we can pull from those titles here. And Boyhood, for me, not in the Pantheon, though it should be absolutely eligible for this list. So disregard everything we said in our poll question from a few weeks ago, where we excluded Linklater and also anything from 2018, all eligible
Although,
for this top five.
You and I think, both did exclude picks that we made when we did our top five Linklater scenes.
That is true.
Which was on episode 581.
Yeah.
So we had, I only had two there. I had one from Before Sunrise, one from Before Sunset. I think you had four?
I had four, which I told Ethan Hawke, and we didn't get a chance to really completely dive into that. I wanted to break those scenes down one by one, but he's such a good talker and so thoughtful and so engaging that I think I got six questions in that 25 minutes, and we didn't get a chance to do that. You heard him talk about his favorite scene from Before Sunrise in that conversation, the one where he talks Julie Delpy's Celine off the train, and that is a wonderful scene. But yeah, it was only in preparation for talking to Ethan Hawke that I realized four of my five favorite Linklater scenes have Ethan Hawke in them. I tried to avoid those. And I did it successfully and made it a little bit tougher, but I managed to do it for this list. So, Keith, any other thoughts, any criteria that you used for this list as we jump into your number five?
You know, not really. I mean, I thought about avoiding Linklater. I try not to do too much Linklater, but I just kind of gave in. But, but yeah, no, I don't think so.
Okay, let's hear it.
Well, number five. My number five actually comes from a highly acclaimed film called The Purge. Maybe not the most highly acclaimed film, but I wanted to nod to the fact that he does he tends to alternate between small independent films, you know, some of which, you know, are released and celebrated, and some of which, you know, as you mentioned, fly a little under the radar. And genre films, and I think even there, he tends to choose pretty interesting projects. Like The Purge series is something I've followed, and it rarely quite lives up to the potential of its premise, but it's such an interesting premise. I tend to stick with it, and he's in the first film, and there's a scene early on where his kids are asking him about why he and his wife don't participate in Purge Night. He's gotten rich, you know, selling security systems to help out with the Purge, and he gives them this line about how they would if they wanted to, but they don't. It's been really good for the country. I mean, you don't remember what it was like before. There's all this unemployment and poverty, and you know, it's seeing this guy, and I think this is where his history kind of comes in. It's seeing this ultimate, like, no sellout Troy Dyer character who's gotten older and sold out, and maybe he believes his own justifications for it, and maybe he doesn't. But, like, whatever, used to, like, keep the spark of that alive has died out. And it's a small moment in a film that's basically more about, you know, crazy mass killers trying to break into this house. But I think, like a lot of the series, it's a small moment to make it stand out, and I think Hawke does a really good job with it as well.
Really digging into a chance to play against type, maybe.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, we almost did. Not you, Adam, because it was on one of the weeks during the summer where you were going to be on vacation.
Yeah.
We almost did a Purge retrospective because I've always been intrigued by the films as well. Haven't caught any of them. And the timing just didn't work out with the screening for this new one. So I still need to catch those.
Yeah, not to get too off topic. I rewatched them all for a piece I did recently. And it's a fascinating series. It just never quite pushes as far as you want it to, but it's interesting.
You do a nice job in your piece, like you did there, touching on how there are some of these connections in his filmography to characters he's played that kind of go back to that Troy character. And that's something he's cognizant of, too, not to get off on a detour here either. But I read another interview with him where he touched on Juliet Naked, and the movie makes the connection clear because in that film, they use pictures of him as Troy Dyer to represent the 90s version of that former kind of cult rock star, that cult musician. But he saw that character, Tucker Crowe, as an extension of Troy Dyer, kind of making an album and then disappearing. So I just find it fascinating that Ethan Hawke is always thinking about those kind of connections to his past performances.
Yeah, I think it's interesting because, I mean, like, Pierce Brosnan may not have been the greatest Bond, but I think he's kind of interesting as a post-Bond, as a sort of away from Bond, where like the shadow of Bond kind of hovers over, like, performances, like in thinking of Taylor of Panama, where he's like this washed up or sort of like turn, you know, as a spy, an unscrupulous spy. You know, I think Ethan Hawke's got a little bit of that going on with some of his earlier roles as well.
Josh, your number five, Ethan Hawke moment.
All right, really quickly before I jump in, just want to get out there those two picks I did have before on my Linklater list, because both of them came up. We got great listener suggestions for this on social media, and both of these came up a lot. The Listening Booth from Before Sunrise, and then Before Sunset, I think this was the most mentioned one I saw. Baby, You're Going to Miss That Plane.
Yes.
We both had that one, Adam.
We did.
On our Linklater scenes list. So those two I didn't want to use again. My number five, I'm going to go to Reality Bites, and it's the moment, the line he has is, "What is it that you want from me?" I'd like to revisit. I wish, you know, Adam, you had a chance to do this. I'd really like to revisit Reality Bites in whole to see if it does hold up. It came out while I was in college. And so it struck me, Keith, I think probably, you know, I'm just a couple years younger. So it felt a little bit still being in college and not like in the real world yet as this funny, revealing portrait of.
In college, too. I'm not that old.
Okay. But for me, it was kind of like, oh, is that what it's like out there? When you get out of college, it looked funny. It looked, you know, I liked it. I remember liking the performances a lot, including Hawk, but also Janine Garofalo, Steve Zahn, Ben Stiller, who was also the director, of course. And then, of course, Winona Ryder and Ethan Hawke in the lead roles. Troy is, I mean, he's this coffee shop guitarist, aspiring artist who has these principles, but they are often used to cover up this lack of ambition. I think it was the part, though, that gave Hawke his first chance to offer one of his philosophical principled rants, and he would go on to perfect those, of course, in his films with Linklater. And here he is in this scene that I'm picking, arguing with Ryder's more driven, aspiring documentarian.
Just out of curiosity, why are you suddenly acting like a jealous girlfriend?
All right. We're just trying to pay bills here, okay? So, Troy, if you got any money.
Money? Oh, but what's money to an artist, to a philosopher? It's just a green-colored paper that floats in and out of his life like snow. It's nothing you actually have to, I don't know, work for, is it, Troy?
No, not if you have Daddy's little gas card.
You shut up. You shut up! I busted my ass to find a job, any job. You don't even bother showing up for interviews.
What is it that you want from me, huh? What is it? You want me to get a job on the line for the next 20 years until I'm granted leave with my gold-plated watch and my balls full of tumors because I surrendered the one thing that means shit to me? Well, honey, you can just exhale because it's not going to happen, not in this lifetime.
I like it that Ryder gives it back to him in that scene and deflates this pretentious worldview, even while Hawk's intensity has us nodding our heads along with him a little bit. It's contagious, even if we know he's a jerk. There's something contagious about his presentation. And I think this is one of those seeds of what would become Hawk's gift, is playing characters who speak their minds with such passion and such conviction, but they're often equally willing to reconsider those positions. I think this is what comes out in the Before trilogy, and they can maybe be persuaded otherwise. So he's the actor as conversationalist, first and foremost. Mm-hmm. And this is a great early – it's more of a straight out argument from him, I guess. But you could see where he would go eventually with that dynamic in this scene.
Yeah. And if I recall that scene correctly, she really does win that argument, Winona Ryder. And he finally does just kind of give up.
He literally backs
he
up.
He realizes that there's nothing more he can do there with her. So I'm going to stick with Reality Bites for my number five. And it's true. I just watched this movie for the first time. More or less. I saw it all the time on TV or HBO when I was younger, and I flipped through the channels and I would catch scenes from it. But I had never sat down from start to finish and watched it. I did for this list. And the moment I'm going with is another conversation with Ryder and Ethan Hawke. And it's where he says, "All right, Lelaina, I am really in love with you." This is when he busts Lainey coming home from a night out with Michael, the Ben Stiller character, and she accuses him of acting like a jealous boyfriend, but he's really more of the disapproving father. He's sitting in the living room in the dark, and I love how later he's reading a book and he tries to pass it off like, "I'm just reading a book." The lights were completely off, but he's just waiting for her to walk in and bust her and call her out on having a fling with this guy apparently on the first date. And then when she calls him out on his BS and how she wishes that he would just be man enough to come out and say whatever's on his mind, we get a few different things that make this for me a great Ethan Hawke scene. And maybe this is why it's not a surprise Emmanuel Lubezki shot Reality Bites. Some of the shot choices in the editing here are really, really good. When he gets up after that challenge, the camera rises with him up from the couch as he starts to walk towards her. He's in full silhouette. It's still dark over by the couch. We cut to this kind of semi point of view tracking shot, his point of view moving towards Winona Ryder and looking slightly down on her. And then we cut to a medium close up that goes into a close up of Troy as he emerges from the dark into the light, his eyes fixated on her and his guard seemingly down finally in this moment. Talk about iconic moments that made Troy Dyer, that made Ethan Hawke maybe what he is. That stroll and that close-up with those flowing brown locks, that's enough to forgive any future transgressions. And then he touches her face, and he confesses his love. And he almost has to psych himself up just to touch her. You see what Hawk's doing there, and it's Hawk playing Troy, playing someone in love with her, except that in that moment, it's too real. He's actually too vulnerable. And you see the real Troy come through in that moment. You see his real feelings for her come out. It's a flash, but it's there. And as soon as, I think, Winona Ryder's look changes from one of scorn to sympathy to pity to maybe even love for him, that's way too heavy for him. And then he has to go back to being the old Troy and mocking her for it. And you touched on this, Keith, in your piece and here on the show, how important this movie was as far as kind of setting the tone for how we would all perceive Ethan Hawke for the future. And even though I had never even seen the entire film, that's how I perceived Ethan Hawke. I think obviously other media outlets had something to do with that, but it's just weird. It's not even that good of a film. It's fine, but it's not that good of a film. Again, I never even saw it in full. And then on top of it, it's not like he played these characters again and again. You can find some similarities in someone like Jesse, but he didn't just keep playing Troy Dyer, and yet we all made that same mistake somehow.
It was such a zeitgeist film, though. It was like, even if not everyone accepted this way, it was supposedly this,
right.
The Graduate. Like, it was supposed to be something akin to The Graduate. It's nowhere near that, of course, but that was the reputation.
And I think Hawke's performance in scenes like this and the way he's filmed in scenes like this is a big contributor to that. So let's get back to you, Keith, with your number four, Ethan Hawke scene.
My number four I'm kind of having to draw on memory because it's a film I haven't seen in a while and I couldn't really find this clip online. But it's definitely not one of my top Linklater films, but the movie Fast Food Nation, Ethan Hawke plays a small role, but it's kind of a pivotal one. He's kind of it's a film about corporatization. It's about, based on a nonfiction book about the fast food industry. But there's a part where he's talking to his sister, played by Patricia Arquette, which is strange to consider after Boyhood, and his niece, who works at the fictional McDonald's in the film, and just kind of walking through how it's played out in their town of Cody, Colorado, and says to his sister, like, is Cody better now than when we were growing up? And it's like, what's still left?
You know, I actually think it's better now. There's more stuff to do.
Oh, yeah. There's more to do. You got the Walmart, the Kmart, and the Target, right? I mean, you got Chuck E. Cheese. You got Taco Bell. You got Arby's. You got Mickey's. You got Denny's. You've got Chili's. You've got Applebee's. You got Wendy's. You got Hardee's, right? You got the KFC, the IHOP. Do they still have that Der Wiener Schnitzel?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, thank God it's still hanging in there.
In a film that sometimes airs too much on telling you how things are, it's a very human moment. It kind of walks you through and makes it small. It makes it like, here's what happened and where we grew up, and here's how you can see what I'm talking about playing out on a very local scale. Mm-hmm. And that's, I think, to me, it's one of the moments in the movie that really keeps it grounded, makes it effective more than like, oh, I don't know, endless slaughterhouse footage at the end of the movie.
It's a lighter scene in that movie. That relationship between Arquette and Hawke as brother and sister there, and with the niece, Ashley Johnson, I believe is the actress's name. It's really playful, and it does offer a little bit of comedy, actually, in that otherwise kind of bleak film.
All right, for my number four, I'm going to go back to Dead Poets Society, the sweaty-toothed madman scene. This is where Hawke's shy student, Todd Anderson, he's forced to the front of the class by Robin Williams, John Keating, and prodded into spurting this impromptu poem. Todd jumps off. There's a portrait there of Walt Whitman in the classroom. So he jumps off that and gives in to this stream of consciousness he didn't know he had in him.
Picture of Uncle Walt up there. What does he remind you of?
Don't think. Answer. Go on.
A madman.
What kind of madman? Well, think about it. Just answer again.
A crazy madman.
Oh, you can do better than that. Free up your mind. Use your imagination. Say the first thing that pops into your head, even if it's total gibberish.
Go on. A sweaty-toothed madman.
Good God, boy. There's a poet in you after all.
There. Close your eyes.
Close your eyes.
Close them.
Now. Describe what you see.
I close my eyes.
Yes.
And this image floats beside me.
The sweaty-toothed madman.
The sweaty-toothed madman with a stare that pounds my brain.
Oh, that's excellent. Now give him action. Make him do something.
His hands reach out and choke me.
That's wonderful, wonderful.
And all the time he's mumbling.
What's he mumbling?
Mumbling truth. Yeah. Truth like a blanket that always leaves your feet cold.
Forget them. Stay with the blanket. Tell me about that blanket.
You push it, stretch it, it'll never be enough. You kick at it, beat it, it'll never cover any of us. From the moment we enter crying to the moment we leave dying, it'll just cover your face as you wail and cry and scream.
What's impressive here is the sense of self-surprise that Hawke brings. So Todd has to shock himself as much as us, as much as Keating. He has to shock himself that he has this barbaric yawp inside him. And we really believe that he does surprise himself here because of the rawness and the freshness that Hawk embodies. I found a 2014 interview with HitFix and Up Rocks, and Hawk described this scene as, quote, the first time I ever felt like I had actually had the experience of acting. And he goes on here, I thought this was really fascinating. Somehow it's like you're not breathing, you're being breathed. And the first time I ever had that feeling was with Robin Williams. That scene is pretty much shot in one take. It's cut a little bit, but Peter Weir shot it on a Steadicam spinning around us. I remember Robin hugging me after the scene was over. It's a high I've been chasing the rest of my life. Mm. So it sounds like, you know, Williams Keating not only freed Todd Anderson in the movie, but he may also have unleashed Ethan Hawke as an actor.
Maybe
in a
so.
Way.
Yeah.
And I never thought about the movie in that way, or even Williams as that sort of collaborative actor. Hmm. We did review, we gave a Sacred Cow review to Dead Poets Society on episode 502. So if anyone's interested in digging more into that, you can do it on episode 502.
Keith, I love that you gave some love to Fast Food Nation. I think it's an underappreciated Richard Linklater movie. I'm going to give some more love to it with my number four. And actually, it's the scene right before the one you chose. And it's an important scene for me for a couple of reasons. One of them is it's the first time where I actually recognize Ethan Hawke as a character actor, someone who could walk into a movie in a small role, didn't necessarily have to be the lead, and I would actually be really happy to see him on screen. For me, it's maybe the earliest entry into the Hawkening that we are in right now. And it's also a scene, it's one where he is talking with his niece, Amber, at the bar right before they come home to talk with Patricia Arquette. And it's Hawk pontificating, as he does so well, but instead of it being tied up in the messiness and the pain and ecstasy of romantic love like he was with Winona Ryder in Reality Bites, he's actually being nurturing here. He's gone from the too cool slacker Troy to now the too cool uncle. And he's challenging his niece, just like he's challenging Lainey in some of the scenes we've talked about, specifically about her decision to go to work for Mickey's.
Well, I need the money. I really do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no other jobs, right? You tried SPCA, you tried the park services, you tried daycare, right? Nobody around here needs their kids to be taken care of?
It was the first job I could find.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, a friend of mine worked there. What do you want to hear?
I'm not criticizing you. All right, I think you are great. I just want to know your timeline for getting out of here.
So that's Troy Dyer again. He's being critical of someone else's life choices. It's someone he cares deeply about, but instead of attacking as a means of self-preservation, he genuinely is supporting her, and he's doing it selflessly. And actually, if you look at that uncle character, the way he talks about himself in his own life, he probably has little hope for what he's going to do with the rest of his life, but he has a lot of hope for her, and so he's trying to be a guide. And then we get the ultimate Hawk transition.
I read this study the other day about people who are happiest with their lives.
So I'm thinking, if Ethan Hawke ever writes an autobiography, "I read this study the other day" should be the title of the book, because with so many actors, that type of transition would be ponderous and pretentious, and maybe it is a little bit that with Hawke too, but I'd say it's mostly effortless, and it doesn't feel pretentious or pedantic, though it is pedagogical. There is a lot of teaching. We even heard it in my interview with Ethan Hawke. And whatever it is inherently in him to be someone who engages in these types of conversation, Hawke, the person, he seems to want to be part of a dialogue, an exchange of ideas. And I think he is the same person you hear and read in interviews. He comes through in scenes like this. This is the character who I now think of when I think of Ethan Hawke, or at least who I think of first when I think of Ethan Hawke. Not Uncle Pete, but this version of Hawke, this persona, and it all culminates with Hawke saying, if you want to be like everybody else, just do what everybody's telling you to do.
Has he played a college professor? Because
he does of sorts in Maggie's Plan.
Okay.
Isn't that?
I haven't seen that one.
Yeah, Maggie's Plan is a good movie, Gerwig, a film with Greta Gerwig and Julianne Moore, and I think actually he is Greta Gerwig's like creative writing teacher.
It just seems like that's and from your interview too, it's kind of how he lives life.
Exactly.
And so many of his characters are exactly that way too.
Yep. Keith, you're number three.
I'm going to go kind of back to someone who doesn't really know enough about the world, and that's Training Day. And, you know, I was reading it I read a study the other day. I was reading an interview with Ethan Hawke a couple of days ago, and he talked about how he felt like Denzel Washington selected him for this film because he needed someone he could play off of. And I think, you know, you watch this film and you know he knows he's not the lead of this movie. He knows that this is just to – he can do great work, but he's there for Denzel Washington to bounce off of. And that scene together of them together at the diner at the beginning where he says, you know, tell me a story. I mean, he's, you know, getting big dogged by Denzel Washington from the beginning. Like he's – putting him off his guard, you know, making, you know, he's playing head games with him, but it's a good scene. It's a scene where he says, tell me a story. And he actually tells a good story. It's an interesting story about a DUI. That's actually a drug dealer trying to kill someone. And I forget the details. And you can tell he's enjoying it. You can tell he's like, feel like maybe he's bonding with this guy who's putting him off his balance. And he's not, you know, you realize by the end of the scene, just he realizes as well, how in over his head he is. It's a great moment.
Right, plates run clean, and so I field test and arrest, and I'm belting him in our unit, and Debbie's tossing his car. She calls me over to the vehicle and shows me a snub 38 and two shotguns fully loaded and locked.
No.
So she calls our supervisor, and I keep searching. I find 500 grams of meth in the dash. Turns out this DUI is on bail for distribution. It's on his way to smoke his ex-partner before trial.
Boom.
We prevented a murder.
You got him. It's amazing. It is that you could be out there with a fine for a year, and the most entertaining story that you can come up with to tell me is a drunk stop,
which is actually the scene that we performed
pretty familiar
in Massacre Theater a few weeks ago. I mean, honestly, I think we did it better. That's a great pick,
yeah.
Keith.
I mean, dare you. Washington and Hawker, you know, pretty good.
They're okay
compared to us.
Yeah.
All right, number three, which pairs well with your pick there, Keith, because I think. You know, we know Hawke can do charming, but what you highlighted there is the way he can also excel at panic, that moment when he realizes he's really in trouble. And a lot of that happens in Training Day. I thought about making a Training Day pick for this quality, but instead I'm going with Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, the late career crime drama from director Sidney Lumet. It's about two desperate brothers who plan an ill-advised heist that goes awry. Hawke and Philip Seymour Hoffman are the brothers. So Hoffman is the dominant figure in this relationship. And there's a conversation between them. This is after things have blown up in their faces, where Hoffman dances between consoling and just eviscerating his brother.
Did you clean the car? Did you wipe the car down?
Uh-huh. Totally.
Did you leave anything in the car?
No, of course not.
We're probably okay. If they don't connect the car to us, we're probably okay.
That's what I was thinking.
Go back to work, totally normal. Okay.
So sorry, Andy. I'm so sorry. Oh, I don't think I can get through this.
Shut up.
I loved her so much.
Shut the f*** up.
Hoffman is great, of course, but don't sleep on the nonverbal acting that
I know
Hawk
where you're going with this.
Is doing here. And literally, in the case of that anguished moan at the end, his face gets longer and longer as the scene goes on until he almost resembles the mask in the Scream movies. It's incredible what's happening to his face there. I think sometimes you can measure an actor by how they hold up across from a really, really great actor. And here in this movie, Hawke not only hones his own against Philip Seymour Hoffman, but there's another scene I considered where he drips with panic, and at the other side of the table is Michael Shannon. And so in both of those, Hawke is doing variations on that same thing. He's just in a state of panic throughout this whole film.
Yes.
And it's amazing stuff. It's the opposite of that self-confident sort of charm that he has in so many of his movies. If for some reason Before the Devil Knows You're Dead has slipped past you, check it out.
I think it was one discussed here on the show when it came out, me and Sam. He really went for it, and I did not. I had a more mixed reaction. Definitely wasn't all negative, but was mixed on it. It's one I really need to revisit. And I thought you were going to mention this is maybe more of a Hoffman moment, but actually it's really in Hawke's response. I love the way Lumet films that scene where we get that shot of Hawke, and we see him sitting at the table, kind of medium close-up, and we're not seeing Hoffman's whole body at one point.
No, we see
his
fist.
Right, and he touches Ethan Hawke's shoulder, like right by his neck, almost like a pressure point. And it's clearly supposed to be an affectionate touch, like it's going to be okay. But the way he touches him, the intimidating way he touches him and the intimidated way Hawk responds to
right.
it. It's one of those things where there's real fear there in Hawk, not just for what he's done and what he's caught up in, but he's afraid of his brother.
Oh, yeah.
Hoffman's such an imposing presence in that scene.
It's that mixture there of consoling and just tearing him apart. And the camera, too, is interesting because it's looking at Hawk from a little bit behind, just so that when he turns his face away from Hoffman, you know, he doesn't want his brother to see him crumbling like this. We see it all. It's right there for us.
So I'm going to follow that up with another scene with Ethan Hawk, arguably in panic mode, though a much more subtle version of panic. And it's a moment from the end fight in Richard Linklater's Before Midnight. Actually, not the end fight, but the aftermath of the fight, the end scene of Before Midnight. And I'm drawn to this choice in this movie for a few reasons here. One is I knew that Sunrise and Sunset would likely get a lot of attention on these lists, and that's ahead of us, and Midnight might be overlooked. But also, I look back at my notes from that review, and during that review, I claimed it was my new favorite Ethan Hawke performance, which I'm going to guess was true until I saw Born to Be Blue and then First Reformed and rewatched Before Sunrise this weekend. I have a feeling it's just going to keep happening with Ethan Hawke. And the thing I felt about it then was that it was less reliant on his charm and that smile. And he can't BS his way through some of those conversations the way he did with Delpy in those earlier films. We weren't buying it anymore either. As audience members, he has to work harder to sell it. And there's a lack of vanity to his performance that you really see in his face and in every line of dialogue. And re-listening to my interview with him, he talked about that one insight he had into Chet Baker as an artist when he was making Born to Be Blue, that it was all kind of the actor's trick of being willing to show them how scared you are. There's a moment in this scene where Jesse betrays just how scared he is. And it's when he approaches Celine. She's stormed off out of the hotel room. She's sitting alone. And he goes to her. And they're sitting by the water, like on the deck of a restaurant or something. It's very similar to a scene in Before Sunrise, actually, though, a much more different tone in that one. And he decides to break the ice a little bit by playing a game.
Miss?
I don't want to talk right now.
You by yourself? Are you waiting for somebody?
Yeah, I'm by myself and happy to be. I'm an angry person and I hurt my kids, my work, and everyone I love.
Oh, just my time.
Okay, I'm not in the mood. I came here to be alone.
Hey, listen, I've just been checking you out from across the cafe, and I don't want to make you uncomfortable, but you are by far the best-looking woman in this place.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, and I'd love to buy you a drink, maybe talk to you, get to know you a little bit, you know? I mean, you're here in business? Okay, I see. All right, you have a boyfriend?
Not anymore.
Jeez, sorry to hear that. God, you want to talk about it?
I don't talk to strangers.
Well, that's the thing, I'm not a stranger. No, we've met before.
Oh.
Summer 94.
Mistaking me for someone else?
No. We even fell in love.
Really? Mm-hmm.
So this is a more weary version, but the same Jesse we fell in love with and that she fell in love with is there. He's being more charming and light and playful, but when he says that line, "We even fell in love," that all disappears. There's a real solemnity to the delivery, and there's actually a little crack in his voice when he says that line that betrays to me real fear, genuine fear. When he says fell in love, it's almost as if that was something that happened in the past. And in this moment where they've just come out of a fight where she said, "I don't love you anymore," he is dealing with the fact that maybe they did fall in love in the summer of 1994, but that's not going to be part of their present or their future. I also love this scene because it provides an important connection for me to the whole series, in that at this key moment, at this crossroads really in their relationship, they revert back to what helped them connect initially, which is acting, which is role-playing. We get this little game just like we got in one of my other favorite Richard Linklater scenes, the one in Before Sunrise where they're sitting in a cafe and they talk on the telephone as if they are talking about the person they're sitting across from to one of their best friends back home. So it's a game, and by being a game, it's artifice, it isn't real, but it allows you to get at something that is, and that scene does eventually provoke the kind of epiphany, hopefully, that we're looking for, that he's looking for. And that whole idea of kind of role-playing and acting in that sense, it's certainly a key component of Linklater's art and arguably of art in general. So that for me is just such an integral part of what all those movies are about. But when he says that line, you just hear that subtle crack in his voice.
Well, I mean, talk about nonverbal acting too. At that point in the series, the amount of the stuff going on between them that isn't in the dialogue is just incredible. And certainly that's a big part of that final sequence.
We are now ready to share our top two Ethan Hawke scenes, our expert, Keith Phipps, and that he just wrote about Ethan Hawke and his career. He's ready to deliver his number two.
So Boyhood's kind of there's a lot of things you could choose from Boyhood, and Ethan Hawke is very much a supporting player in that. But when he's in the film, it's you know, he has his moments, and I love the Black Album moment where he's trying to share this double disc CD compilation he's made with artwork and everything of a fictional Beatles albums, taking the best of their 70s solo work and tying it together as if it were one album that the Beatles made. And apparently this is Hawke's own invention. The Black Album is his own thing he came up with. So it's a little bit of himself bleeding into the character there, which makes it a little even more effective. But it is, you know, beyond the commentary on the songs and the Beatles' career and all that, it's a real moment of trying to connect with his son and using culture to do that and maybe getting there, maybe not, you know. And it's a good album. I've made this compilation to get myself and listen to it. It is a nice alternate view of the Beatles solo careers. But it's like so much in that movie. It's a small moment, but it's a small moment that reveals a lot about who these people are and where they're going. It's a great scene.
Yes. So I mean, look at that. Top of Volume Two, first four tracks. You got Band on the Run, Into My Sweet Lord, Into Jealous Guy, Into Photograph. But come on. It's like the perfect segue. You got Paul who takes you to the party. George who talks to you about God. John who says, no, it's about love and pain. And then Ringo who just says, hey, can we enjoy what we have while we have it?
It is a great scene. Really good. And that's why it made my top five classic rock scenes, classic rock moments in movies.
Yeah, when we talked about recently.
I've missed some episodes.
All good. Yeah. I just want to point it out that if you want to hear me go on way too long about the magic of that scene, it was part of that episode. I don't remember the exact episode number, but it's the one Stephen Hayden, appeared on. We talked about his new book, Twilight of the Gods, and shared our top five classic rock moments in movies. And even though the way Band on the Run is specifically used coming out of that scene isn't what you would think of as one of those all-time great classic rock moments, it's the conversation about the music before we get to that transitional moment that really is wondrous. So, great pick.
You know what I love about that dad character in that film is, and this is part of Hawke's performance, is he's not, at least when it comes to the relationship with his son, he's not playing any games. You know, it's just he's putting himself out there with his passions and his take on things, and it's sort of take it or leave it attitude. And of course he's hoping, you can sense that he's dying with hope that the son will take it and be there with him on this. But I love that he just kind of puts himself out there. So it's a great performance.
Well, it's a moment of vulnerability when you're sharing something you love with your kid.
Yeah,
for sure.
And it's like, I hope you love this too.
That was me watching Before Sunrise with my daughter this weekend.
Oh, okay. So you did that.
Yeah,
then.
I did that. Okay. And I said earlier on the show, but she loved it. So
okay, good.
Actually, she responded the way probably Ethan Hawke's character in that scene wished that his son had responded to it. He was curious, but maybe not rapturous for what he was selling at that point.
He wasn't smothering him in thanks.
No.
Yeah, I mean, I've got a 7-year-old, and so, you know, I try not to push anything on her, but it's just like, you know, you might enjoy this.
Dropping some hints.
You might enjoy this Iron Giant film.
Here's Pavement. What music are you making her listen to at seven?
We have the Beatles on a lot, actually.
Okay.
And she's taken to that. And I never want to be, there's like, I forget the headline, but there's an Onion article about the hipster dad pushing their choice their choices on their kid, and it's like this little girl holding up a copy of a Big Star album. It's like, I never want to be that guy.
You don't want to.
So I just kind of, you know, we put stuff on. She likes it. She likes it. If she doesn't, you know, that's okay too.
That's the right way to approach
it. Big huff and stomp out of the room. Good. Exactly. Good parenting choice there.
You're number two, Josh.
I'm going to stick with Linklater. And while considering options, what other Richard Linklater scenes with Hawk that I could put on this list, I came upon this on Twitter from @IllumistOfStyle. It's really hard to single out individual scenes from his Linklater stuff because that isn't really how those movies work. I think that's true to an extent. Hawk scenes in a lot of Linklater's films are conversations that build to a great moment, but sometimes you need all that relational context to really appreciate what you're getting there. But then Brendan Cassidy, he's of the In Session Film podcast, he shared a GIF on Twitter of a precise moment from Before Sunrise. It comes during the Q&A scene on the tram where they're peppering each other with questions, and Julie Delpy's Celine is sharing about her first crush. Her hair falls in front of her face, and Hawk's Jesse instinctively reaches out to brush it back. But then she turns to face him, and he quickly withdraws his hand before she notices. So I love the particularity of Brendan's choice here of going with something that's a gesture, that's not a conversation, and what I'm thinking must have been an improvised moment. There's something a little forward about it on Jesse's part.
Totally.
I mean, you know, he's taking a liberty here, but I like to think that he's also genuinely motivated by the fact that he can't see her face.
Yeah, that's it.
You know, that's what's driving him. Her hair is obstructing this great conversation
Absolutely.
They're having. So we're right, you know, it's a gesture, but we're right back to this idea of being the conversationalist and that this is getting in the way of their connection.
Hmm.
And it also, it speaks to that brilliant dynamic that Hawk and Delpy have throughout this series. It does make me wonder, thinking about your pick too, Adam, how much of what we think of Ethan Hawke as an actor should be credited to Julie Delpy? I mean, 30%, maybe 40, maybe 40. I mean, look at that filmography and the great stuff. A lot of it has to do with her.
Fair
and of course,
question.
You could say the reverse. So
there's going to be a lot more talking about that scene, or at least some more talking about that scene as we get through our picks. My number two Hawke moment, I'm going to go away from Richard Linklater, and I'm going with the scene from Born to Be Blue, where he plays Chet Baker. I've already covered what might be my favorite scene from the movie, the My Funny Valentine scene, where he performs that. He's trying to make a comeback. You heard me talk about it in the interview with Ethan Hawke and also on our blowout show where we reflected on our favorite moments of the year, kind of that rap party I think we did live a few years ago at the University of Chicago. I think that was the show where I talked in a little bit more detail about that scene as one of my music moments of the year. So I excluded it, but this moment is the sister scene to that one. And it's the end of Born to Be Blue. I want people who haven't caught up with this movie yet, Josh, I think you're one of them.
I have not.
Okay. I want people to see this movie. So I'm going to try actually to not kind of spoil this moment and the overall significance of it. But it's another example. I said it's a sister scene to that My Funny Valentine scene because it's another one where Chet Baker is singing in addition to playing the trumpet. It's another crucial performance in his comeback. He's actually here playing at Birdland, and he's trying to impress a couple of audience members, just Miles Davis and Dizzy Gillespie, who have kind of dismissed him before. And again, his love interest, Jane, played by the great Carmen Ejogo, she's there to support him. She's the one who has nursed him back to health after he was beaten, helped bring him back on the precipice of really having his career back. And again, it's a scene where he's singing ostensibly to her. We see a lot of shots where he's making eye contact with her. Except, as I said, there's even more writing on this performance. In addition to his career, his life and their life together is also at stake because there's this question hanging over a good chunk of the performance, which is, did he use heroin before he went out on stage? Because he's one of these guys who thinks he needs it to be in the right state of mind to perform at his best? Or did he go for it, go out on stage without that support, and instead decide just to rely on his talent and the support of Jane?
I've never been in love before. Now all at once it's you. It's you forevermore.
It's a very tense scene because we know what's at stake. And just like Jane, we're watching the performance like we're detectives, right? We're looking for any movement, any something in his voice as he sings or in his trumpet playing as he's performing I've Never Been in Love Before, something that's going to reveal whether or not he did use heroin. And we're also watching Jane watch him because we're scanning her face to see if she detected anything. And I'll just say we both do get our answer, and it comes in a gesture. Just like an actor might employ a kind of psychological gesture where they use this one kind of movement to reveal something about their psyche, here it's the character, Chet Baker, revealing a truth. It just comes out of the performance, and just the way he moves his hands across his face, it tells you everything you need to know about that end scene. And the whole thing is just Hawk walking the most tenuous of tightropes. In the interview, he talked a couple times about fragile and fragility and the importance of that as an actor. That is this scene in spades. And for whatever it's worth, I don't know how many of our scenes do fit this criterion, but it's not Hawk playing a version of Ethan Hawke like I talked about in the case of Fast Food Nation, or maybe when we think of him as that Troy Dyer persona or one of the before movies. Here, it's him really disappearing into a character.
Yeah, that's a really good movie. I like it as a lot, too. And that's the place to end the movie, too. I mean, it's, you know, I like biopics, you know, that know what part of the story to tell. And you know what the rest of this man's life is going to be like. And if you don't know what happened to Chet Baker after this, not so great. You can tell the path this guy is going to walk until he can't walk it anymore. And it's sad, and also kind of, you know, you don't want to romanticize those choices too much, but also with Chet Baker, it's kind of hard not to in some ways. And he really is someone who seemed like perhaps his art was wrapped up in these awful choices he'd make. And this movie doesn't over romanticize it, but you know, it's a nice bittersweet ending to that movie.
Yeah, bittersweet's a good way to put it. Yeah. I don't think it does over-romanticize the artistry or the choices he makes, and yet we can understand why he makes those choices, and we respect the artistry.
Sure.
That's all there. Yeah. All right, time for number one, our favorite Ethan Hawke moments on screen, Keith Phipps.
So for me, it's Instant Before Sunset, which I'd like to have been filmed before that, but that was to me the moment where I was like, I think I've really underestimated this guy. And I'd liked Before Sunrise and before that, but it hadn't really, it didn't really click for me until I went back to after seeing Before Sunset. And the scene for me is the cab ride where Jesse and Celine have been talking, and now really they're not dancing around what they're trying to say anymore. The sort of the veil has dropped, and he says, "My life is 24/7 bad."
No. I mean, the only happiness I get is when I'm out with my son. I've been to marriage counseling. I've done things I never thought I would have to do. I've lit candles, bought self-help books, lingerie.
Did the candles help?
Hell no. All right, I don't love her the way she needs to be loved, and I don't even see a future for us. But then I look at my little boy sitting at the table across from me, and I think I would suffer any torture to be with him for all the minutes of his life. You know, I don't want to miss out on one. But then there's no joy or laughter in my home, you know, and I don't want him growing up in that.
Oh, no laughter.
And it's sad, and it's, but it's also, you know, there's a little bit of self-justification to it as well. And it's like, you can tell he's maybe, it's also maybe using his own self-pity as a seduction technique, but it's not like it's not genuine. There's just so much swirling around at the same time. And, you know, this character is about my age. And, you know, it's kind of a, made me glad I had not fallen into some of the traps that this character had fallen into, sort of a warning of where your life can go if you're not careful. That to me kind of locked in a connection with this character and this performance and this actor that I'd never really had before. I think that is, you know, if you want to point to one moment in that career that like, you know, kind of pulls out all the stops, everything this guy can do, that's the scene.
Yeah. Another one of my favorite Linklater scenes, in fact, did make my list, my number five.
Yeah. And maybe that's the moment where he's, you know, he's opening up to the disillusionment of some of those other characters that he played before. Obviously Jesse in Before Sunrise, but we're back to Troy too, you know, just envisioning if things took a few wrong turns or a few bad choices, this is where that somewhat romantic figure might be. I wonder if that's also, do you recall, Keith, if that's the sequence where there's a callback to the...
Hey now, there's no reason to get ahead of things, Josh.
Okay.
There's someone who's ready to talk.
Okay.
There's someone who's ready to jump in, eager to speak.
I will retract that statement, Your Honor, and instead go to my number one.
Yeah. Why don't we hold off just a second?
I'll do that. All right, my number one. Well, it comes from your number one movie of the year so far, Adam. My number two, and Keith, sounds like it's pretty high for you as well,
yeah,
First Reformed.
I easily could have picked a scene from this movie, and it's
so we all love it. We all love it. Hawk here playing a distraught pastor in upstate New York who's going through a crisis of faith. Now, this crisis is exacerbated by this meeting he has with the husband of a young woman who attends his church. The husband's become consumed by global warming and mankind's complicity in it. In this scene, Toller, that's Hawk's pastor, and the husband, who's really nicely played by Philip Ettinger, they meet, have this wide-ranging talk, back to a conversation about faith, the future, doubt, belief. So it's just the sort of material that a lot of Hawk's cinematic, philosophical soliloquies have explored. But it's handled very differently here, and that's why I have it at number one. It's both a definitive Ethan Hawke scene in a lot of ways. It's a conversation about big questions, but it's also anti-Ethan Hawke in its execution, thanks to director Paul Schrader, how he employs this sparse transcendental style. And that encourages Hawke to give a really distinct performance for him. He's speaking slowly. He's measuring his words. He's not letting them fly out in a torrent. He's intense, but I don't know if you could say he's passionate in the same way that the young philosopher of the Before films might be, or even Troy from Reality Bites. His voice just really lowers, and it's gravelly. And we can hear in the interview that's happened naturally to him. But here, it's like he doubles down on that, as if this pastor's voice has been just dragged through years of disappointment. I think it's almost as if that instinctive conviction that's the driving force of so many of his chatterbox characters is itself what's coming under interrogation here. So Toller's trying to offer solace to this husband, but you really get the sense that he's just trying to convince himself as well.
Mm-hmm.
So this scene in First Reformed, I do think it's like classic Hawk. It's also something we haven't really seen before. It adds up to my favorite Hawk performance. I still need to see Born to be Blue, so maybe that would sneak ahead of it. But for me, it's my favorite Hawk performance and my number one scene for this list.
In rewatching that scene earlier today, after preparing for this list and making my choices and going through all these moments of intense conviction in these conversations with Ethan Hawke, it's interesting to rewatch that scene in that context, because you recognize all the things you talked about, the different elements to the performance, but also when an Ethan Hawke character is truly passionate about what he's saying, that conviction is undeniable.
Sure.
And while the marrow of what he's saying, there's conviction there, you can really tell that there's something hollow in it.
Oh,
There's some emptiness in some of those phrases he's going to as a pastor.
For sure.
In that moment that otherwise you might not catch on to, but it's there in Hawk's performance.
And I don't know if he's given that sort of shade to a character before, where he's having to do it at the same time along with that conviction.
Yeah, it's an intellectual sparring match. And I think in the diary entry later, he talks about how he was thrilled by
energized by it, yeah.
But at the same time, you know, these ideas get in his head, and I feel like they you know, they serve as a catalyst to the crisis he's already undergoing. And you know, that's a scene that's going to echo through the rest of the film.
For sure.
All right, my number one Ethan Hawke moment. I'm going to go back to where Josh was trying to go just a few moments ago. I'm going to make that link explicitly clear between Keith's number one Ethan Hawke moment and your number two, Josh, because I am going with the same scene you went with, the Q&A.
Okay.
It's Q&A time on the back of that streetcar early and before sunrise with Julie Delpy and Ethan Hawke. And the link I'm going to make is precisely why it's my favorite Hawke moment. It's another gesture. It's something I couldn't believe when I saw it watching Before Sunrise again this weekend. It's something I hadn't noticed on two previous viewings. But first, a little bit more setup. They're on the streetcar. They're in the back seat. It's a straight-on two-shot. And I don't know if it's intentional on Linklater's part or not, but it reminds me of The Graduate. It seems like a harken back to that end scene of The Graduate with this young couple, though they're in a completely different part of their relationship, of course. And even without the link, we're going to talk about more, it might have been my number one anyway, just because I appreciate it so much as this charming, really flawlessly acted single take of acting. And I didn't do the math, but it's over 5 minutes long. It's like a 7 to 10 minute one take of those two having this wonderful encounter with each other. And she is always turned towards him early in the scene so he can see her whole face. Her hair is always back, except for that point. It's about a minute 20 into the scene where she's talking about that former boyfriend or a guy that a friend of hers had a crush on, and he officially asks her out on a date. And in that moment, she looks straight down for the first time away from him, and that hair falls, and he can't see her face, so he reaches to move that hair away. And I don't know if you really said this explicitly or not, Josh, but he doesn't, as far as I see it, ever touch her hair.
He pulls back when she turns her face. Yeah.
But yeah, he pulls back because just at the moment that he's about to touch her hair, she looks up and he's caught and he pulls back. And just that whole kind of silly little back and forth that happens where he pulls his hand away and then she pushes the hair back for him is delightful. And I do think, Josh, it's partly that he feels comfortable enough. Kind of the charge we get as viewers watching that moment is partly that he feels comfortable enough after such a short time with her that he feels like he could do that, that he could touch her hair. That's his instinct to do. But also, he probably knows that he doesn't know her well enough yet, and he might have pulled back anyway, even if she hadn't caught him. And that does bring us to that cab scene in Before Sunset. Now they're in the back of a cab. It's still a two-shot, a European city going by them in the background, and they've switched sides. Delpy's now on the right side, and they're going from a conversation mainly about sex to now love. And I think back to that scene where that conversation goes from sex to love during the Q&A as well, though they kind of dismiss it. And Ethan Hawke at one point says, it's a complex issue. Well, we see that complex issue playing out now in the cab in the second film. As you touched on, Keith, so well, it's something about his marriage, how off it is. He's expressing regret and pain. And now it's Delpy's character. It's Celine who has the unfulfilled gesture. Her hand reaches over to comfort him. And she's the one who pulls away. But I love that she's comfortable enough, even though, relatively speaking, they still barely know each other in this moment, even though, of course, all this time has passed. But it's her now feeling like she could do that. She could comfort him. It's her instinct to do it. And then she pulls away. So was that completely Linklater? Was that scripted? And he put it there and said, I want that callback to the first scene. Was it Delpy? Yeah. Who thought of it? Was it Hawk? Was it unscripted? And like maybe in that first movie, it was an improv moment that came genuinely out of the scene. I don't know. Rewatching Before Sunrise, I did feel like I had this reverse engineering kind of thing where you start to see connections to Boyhood. The TV show that Jesse pitches to her on the train is basically the movie Boyhood, like chronicling something in real time over multiple years. It's there. And do you remember how Before Sunrise opens? Like the opening scene of Before Sunrise is her moving to go sit back by Jesse accidentally because she's moving to get away from an older, bickering married couple.
Yep.
So there are lots of touches that clearly they've put through all three movies. And yeah, that for me, once I saw that gesture in Sunrise and immediately thought about my favorite scene from Before Sunset, other than maybe the ending of the film, I knew that it was going to make this list. So it's Q&A time is my number one. And lest anyone think that the Hawkening is actually potentially going to end anytime soon, did you guys look at Ethan Hawke's IMDb page, the four projects he has coming up in 2018 or they're in some state of production? It's pretty good. He's reteaming with Robert Boudreau, the director of Born to Be Blue, on Stockholm about the 1973 hostage crisis. Okay, I'm all in on that. He's reteaming with Michael Almereyda for a supporting role in Tonight at Noon. If you look at that cast, it's great. He's in The Kid, which has Dane DeHaan as Billy the Kid. He's playing Sheriff Pat Garrett. Vincent D'Onofrio's directing that. And then if that's not enough, he's in Hirokazu Koreeda's The Truth coming out. Catherine Deneuve is in it, and also Juliette Binoche, who you heard him rightfully say in our interview that she's a first ballot Hall of Famer. So I don't know if he knew then that he was going to be working with her. I think it's in pre-production at this point, but it sounds like he's just continuing to make some pretty great choices.
Yeah, promising stuff.
So any honorable mentions? We've thrown out a lot of other scenes. We've covered a lot of ground. Were there any Keith or Josh that you feel bad that haven't come up?
We haven't really talked that much about Juliet naked. Did you talk about it in a previous episode?
A little bit, just
yeah,
briefly.
I don't think it's a perfect movie, but I really like all the relationship between his character and Rose Byrne. So it basically takes over the movie at a certain point. And I just love that he lets himself just be unkempt and you know, not cool looking. I mean, this is a guy, you know, he has a heart attack. He's worried about climbing the stairs. Spoiler, when they finally do get together, there's like, can I actually have sex with you physically? I'm not sure that that's something I can do. You know, it's just a vulnerability and made me look forward to what's to come, because I think there are definitely, as he gets older, there are definitely other types of characters he can play, and that's something to keep an eye out for.
Oh yeah, you definitely get the sense he's one of those actors who will lean into and make the most of his age as he does get older as a performer. So my honorable mentions, I mean, you know, it's the cheesy pick, but it's so hard to resist the "Oh Captain, My Captain" in Dead Poets Society. Yeah. It does still work. The moment still works, and Hawk is great in it. The one I did consider from Gattaca is another moment of panic, actually, when he's talking to Jude Law and is afraid of getting caught. They will recognize me, and he's just at his wit's end there. And I do like a panicky Ethan Hawke as well.
Yeah. I considered a moment from Gattaca, one of the climactic moments, I guess, where, well, I won't say it if people haven't seen Gattaca from 20 years ago or whatever, but it's where he is talking to a policeman character at the end of the film, and they have a confrontation, and there's a line he has. People who know this film and love it will know exactly what I'm talking about, where he says, "Who are you trying to convince?" to the other guy. And the way Ethan Hawke just slightly cocks his head is just so perfect in that moment. I think you've heard 3 of the 4 Richard Linklater scenes that I excluded from this list because they'd come up before. I'm not going to rehash all of them or the 4th one here. I will link to those, though, on the top 5 page over at filmspotting.net. If you click on lists, you can find these lists and links to some of our other choices. One of the obvious ones that you excluded, but I left off too because I knew you were going to go down that path with Linklater, the listening booth scene, "Come Here" in Before Sunrise.
So good.
It really is. Lots more we could probably choose from and we probably forgot about. We look forward to hearing your picks and comments on ours. You can email us, feedback@filmspotting.net.
Keith, so glad you could join us for this. Bring your Hawk expertise. Besides that article, which is at theringer.com, what else are you working on that folks should check out?
Oh, I'm kind of all over the place these days. I mean, I'm writing for Vulture and Rolling Stone and The Verge, and yeah, there got some stuff coming up for The Ringer, which I'm looking forward to doing. So, I mean, you can find me on Twitter at kphipps3000. I collect my clips at keithphipps.com. I do the Next Picture Show podcast.
Just a little podcast.
What's that?
Just a little podcast.
Yeah. I actually picked up another podcast. I do a podcast called Random Movie Night with a former coworker of mine named Mike Ryan, where we just watch a movie chosen by a random number generator, which can be very odd.
That's fun.
Oh, good. Poltergeist 2. Anyway, thanks for having me on, guys.
Yes. You got it. Hey, I got to compliment your Next Picture Show bit where you read your intro as Quint from Jaws. The Jaws, the Meg pairing. I mean, that was good stuff. That was Massacre Theater quality stuff.
One take, guys. One take. And I said to Tasha and Genevieve, I missed my calling. I should have just done this professionally.
I haven't heard that episode yet. Yeah. I didn't know you had it in you. Oh, some acting chops?
I was handed a script and said, here, read this. I was like, okay. Read this as Quint. I was like, all right.
And trust me, it's
gold. Talent.
Challenge
it's
accepted.
Gold. That's talent.
Challenge accepted.
Thanks again, Keith. Right. Over at filmspotting.net, you can find 13 years of reviews, interviews, and top fives in the show archives. Also at filmspotting.net, vote in the current film spotting poll, another very confusing film spotting poll where we have the term historical epics in quotation marks.
It'll basically be easier. Just go there and read it.
Yeah.
That'll make a lot more sense.
And just vote and don't think about it. If you haven't already, please do check out our sister show featuring the great Keith Phipps, The Next Picture Show. You can get it wherever you listen to podcasts. Out in wide release this weekend, The Nun, a priest with a haunted past and a novice on the threshold of her final vows, are sent by the Vatican to investigate the death of a young nun in Romania and confront a malevolent force in the form of a demonic nun.
There is no way that movie needs a plot line that long.
Seriously, that might be longer than the film. I hope it is. Peppermint is also out. A mother with nothing to lose takes from her enemies the very life they stole from her. Now we're talking. A concise, pithy, revenge thriller synopsis. It stars Jennifer Garner. We're not going to see either of those films.
I think this is a good gun to your head week for Adam Kempinar.
Yeah, well,
which one? Which one?
Oh, man. Wow.
Come on. You've got to see one. You're going to the movies no matter what, Adam.
Here's the deciding factor.
Yes.
That is an unknown variable. How long are they?
No.
Yeah.
You got to go.
Whichever one shorter.
You got to go with this incredibly long plot description.
Whichever one shorter.
I think it's going to be Peppermint.
I'm going to go with Peppermint based on the plot description then. Next week on the show, we are planning to talk about not Predator, not Predators, but The Predator.
That's correct.
And we think we just might have an argument or two about our five favorite 80s action movies / franchises, and we're going to power rank them,
yes,
just like with the Chris's.
So Diehards versus the Lethal Weapons versus the is Raiders and Indiana Jones considered in group? We got to get to all this.
Yeah, we don't have time for this, but it's just now occurring to me. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag, but I think I might try to align my 80s choices with a Chris. Which one's Chris Pratt? Which one's Chris Pine? It could be fun. Which one would we like to see Chris Pine star in a new version?
To make this more complicated.
I'm overthinking this, I'm going to make it more fun.
Film Spotting is produced by Golden Joe Dussault and Sam Van Halgren. Without Sam and Golden Joe, this show wouldn't go. Our production assistant is Andy Mitchell. Thanks also to Candace Griffiths and the listeners of the Film Spotting Advisory Board. And special thanks to everyone at WBEZ Chicago. More information is available at WBEZ.org. We would really appreciate it if you gave us a rating or a review on Apple Podcasts. It's a great way for us to reach new listeners. So give us a hand. Help us do that. Our music this week comes from Blaze Foley. More information is at blazefoley.com. For Film Spotting, I'm Josh Larson.
And I'm Adam Kempinar. Thanks for listening.
This conversation can serve no purpose anymore. Goodbye.
Film Spotting is listener supported. Join the Film Spotting family at filmspottingfamily.com and get access to ad-free episodes, monthly bonus shows, our weekly newsletter, and for the first time, all in one place, the entire Film Spotting archive going back to 2005. That's at filmspottingfamily.com.